You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Takes on the World News.
Welcome you to the April 4th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that usually comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., who is perhaps the most dedicated pursuer of justice in America in our lifetimes. On another April 4th, 51 years ago, and a year to the day before he would be gunned down in Memphis, King made a major speech against the Vietnam War, which has been largely erased from history by our mainstream media, as it has from the history texts of our nation's public schools. In that speech, which many believe led to his death, King broke a promise to President Johnson to stick to civil rights and keep his mouth shut about the war, but having been shown photographs of what American forces had done to the people of Vietnam, King told a packed crowd at New York's Riverside Church he could no longer keep silent. He spoke passionately that day not only about the injustices of the Vietnam War, but also of the other criminal activities that had been committed by the self-selected leader of the free world, declaring that the United States is, quote, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, end quote. A half century later, with the U.S. engaged to some degree in at least seven wars, the truth of King's conclusion that day cannot be challenged. In 1935, 53 years earlier, former Marine General Smedley Butler, a two-time Medal of Honor winner, put it another way, quote, "War is just a racket," he wrote. "I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service. During that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism," end quote. Well, that was the way my guest later today on Takes on the World, Major Danny Scherson, introduced his latest article yesterday on antiwar.com titled "Unbridgeable Gap, Who We Were and Who We Thought We Were," the point of his article being that, quote, "American soldiers were led to believe they fought for democracy and freedom these past 17 years. The truth was far murkier," end quote. It is one of a number of articles that Major Scherson has written in recent days on the antiwar.com and TruthDig websites related to America's ongoing wars and the public and Congress's deplorable response to them. I last spoke with Major Scherson on September 17th on the same subject, and being, it seems, on the eye of perhaps another and far wider major war in the Middle East, I am looking forward to renewing my conversation with him at 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. On several of my programs since the first of the year, you have heard me refer to an unprecedented, comprehensive secret agreement signed last December 12th between the intelligence agencies of Israel and the U.S., designed to target Iran and all of its activities at home in Syria and in Lebanon. The existence of the deal was revealed on Israeli television December 28th, and after having confirmed in Washington that the story was accurate by the English-language Times of Israel the very same day. That more than 3 months later, the story is yet to be revealed by a single American news outlet, should raise, if not answer, questions about who and what are controlling the U.S. media. What has since made the ongoing silence by the media of that story even more sinister is that in recent weeks, two of the last three members of President Trump's cabinet who opposed the U.S. decertifying of the multi-nation agreement with Iran to reduce and freeze its nuclear enrichment, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, were unceremoniously fired and replaced by two unbridled war hawks, CIA Director Mike Pompeo and former U.S. UN Ambassador John Bolton, respectively. The fired two, by no coincidence, were both targets of the man who is clearly pulling the president's strings when it comes to his Middle East policy. That's Jewish mega-billionaire and Las Vegas casino owner Sheldon Adelson, who contributed at least $35 million to Trump's election campaign and reportedly was primarily responsible for the president's decision to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and selecting Bolton to be his national security advisor. Bolton's interviews on Fox News and op-ed articles in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal calling for bombing both Iran and North Korea have frightened members of both parties as well as the editorial boards of the major newspapers who have denounced the appointment editorially as one of the worst any president has made. To be sure, the selection of Bolton was welcome in Israel, where it is no doubt remembered that while serving as George Bush's U.N. ambassador, he was hailed by Israel's U.N. ambassador, Dan Gilliman, as, quote, the sixth man in our office. What Adelson may have admired in Bolton is not only his devotion to Israel, but that he, like Adelson, has voiced support for bombing Iran, although he has not gone so far as Adelson himself, who 5 years ago in a public forum in New York called for the U.S. to drop a nuclear bomb on Iran to get its attention and compliance with U.S. demands. As the Times of Israel reported on October 24, 2013, quote, American Jewish billionaire Sheldon Adelson said the United States should detonate a nuclear bomb in the Iranian desert to display toughness, though without hurting a soul, before the next stage of negotiations with Tehran. It should then threaten that the next bomb would fall on Tehran, he said. What are we going to negotiate about? Adelson told a crowd at New York's Yeshiva University. According to the paper, Adelson said, what I would say is, listen, you see that desert out there? I want to show you something. You pick up your cell phone, you call somewhere in Nebraska, and you say, okay, let it go. And so there's an atomic weapon, goes over ballistic missiles, the middle of the desert, that doesn't hurt a soul. Maybe a couple of rattlesnakes and scorpions or whatever. And then you say, see, the next one is in the middle of Tehran. So we mean business. That's Sheldon Adelson. Well, you can still see this online, as well as another video of Adelson speaking to an audience of English-speaking Israeli Jews in July 2010, when he announced the launch of his free newspaper, Israel Hayom, which since has become Israel's most widely read periodical. It's free. Huh? In this video, he reveals for all to see that his loyalty is to Israel. In a wide-ranging talk describing his vision for the paper, which solidly backs Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Adelson said he wished he had served in the Israeli army rather than the U.S. military, and that he hoped his young son will come back to Israel and be, quote, be a sniper for the IDF, a reference to Israel Defense Forces. I am not an Israeli, he said. The uniform that I wore in the military, unfortunately, was not an Israeli uniform. It was an American uniform, although my wife was in the IDF, and one of my daughters was in the IDF. Our two little boys, one of whom will be bar mitzvah tomorrow, hopefully he'll come back. His hobby is shooting. He'll come back and be a sniper for the IDF. Well, he goes on. All we care about is being good Zionists, being good citizens of Israel, because even though I'm not an Israeli born, Israel's in my heart, he said toward the end of his talk. Now imagine, if you will, what would be going on in the minds of U.S. veterans and members of the military and their families who voted for Donald Trump if they were to listen to or watch Adelson apologize for having served in the U.S. Army while at the same time he appears to be dictating U.S. policy in the Middle East and pushing the country into another far more dangerous war on Israel's behalf. But Adelson, Trump, and Israel have nothing to worry about, at least for the moment, because the media is almost as much under the thumb of Israel and its U.S. lobby as is Congress. Even though the revelation that Adelson prefers Israel to the United States would no doubt help the Democrats gain control over both the House and Senate in the elections this fall, they wouldn't think of using it, fearing, no doubt, that it would provoke a wave of anti-Semitism, and that, for party leaders, is more problematic than the U.S. launching another devastating Middle East war. On a closely related subject, the candidate for the British Labour Party has been viciously attacked by the Jewish Board of Deputies in London, the self-appointed spokesperson for the country's 300,000 Jews, for condoning anti-Semitism within the party, if not being an anti-Semite himself. To press the point, on last Saturday, NPR's Weekend Edition, Scott Simon allowed the head of the Jewish Board of Deputies, Jonathan Arkish, to bash Corbyn and the Labour Party without offering the accused a chance to respond or any indication by Simon that such an effort had been made. Simon, who was apparently using the copy from the New York Times, noted that, quote, the controversy burst out when Mr. Corbyn retweeted a picture of a mural in East London that depicts caricatures of Jewish bankers playing a game of Monopoly on the backs of the world's poor. Mr. Corbyn has apologized and said he should have looked more closely at the mural. The controversy is not just about artwork and raises questions about anti-Semitism and Britain's left wing, said Simon, before introducing Jonathan Arkush, president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews. Let's stop here for a moment. There is and was nothing anti-Semitic about that mural, which was painted on a London wall 6 years ago, and though it has since been painted over, it can still be viewed online. It does indeed show six bankers playing Monopoly on the backs of the world's poor, but only two of them happen to be Jewish. Unless J.P. Morgan and John Rockefeller were secretly Jews, not to mention Aleister Crowley, who was a well-known anti-Semite. Of course, one of them would be Mayor Rothschild, who with his son controlled the banking of Frankfurt, while his other four sons ran the main banking houses in Britain, France, Austria, and Naples in the 19th century. Without apparently bothering to look in the mural himself, Simon left NPR's listeners with the image of a group of Jewish bankers with exaggerated racist stereotypes sitting around a Monopoly board counting their money. Curiously, when the mural appeared 5 years ago, the Board of Jewish Deputies expressed no objections. Arkush then complains that, quote, "We have had a succession of anti-Semitic discourse and incidents inside the Labor Party, and all we've had is words Jeremy Corbyn saying that I abhor racism, but he's done nothing about it." And this week, the patience of the Jewish community in Britain finally ran out. End quote. When Simon asks for other instances of anti-Semitism on the left, Arkush brings up the case of Ken Livingstone, former mayor of London. "He has," says Arkush, "come out in the past 2 years with a nonsensical but very provocative statement, Hitler supported Zionism. So he's tried to bracket support for Israel with Zionism. It took a year before they put him through a disciplinary process, and he was suspended from the party for a year. That was a slap of the wrist. He should have been thrown out," end quote. Well, the truth was that from 1933 to 1939, before World War II, Hitler did support Zionism because its goal of persuading Germany's Jews to move to Palestine coincided with Hitler's desire to rid Germany of non-Aryan and particularly its Jewish population. Thus, the only Jewish organizations that were allowed to function in the Third Reich were those of the Zionists who represented a small minority of Germany's Jews. What was critical, however, was the plan agreed to by the Zionists in Palestine and the Nazis, referred to as the Havera, or transfer agreement, that was administered by Adolf Eichmann. It allowed German Jews who wished to leave to buy German goods with that, what money they had, which was then shipped on German ships to Palestine, at which point the new Jewish arrivals would claim and resell the goods. In addition, Eichmann, who was in charge of the operation on the German side, allowed young Jews who planned to go to Palestine to learn farming techniques before they embarked. All of this is well documented and in common knowledge in Israel, but largely kept a secret outside of it. Those like former London Mayor Ken Livingstone who reveal the secret pay a price, as some years back did Colin Edwards, a former correspondent for the Canadian Broadcasting Company, who was fired by the manager of KALW in San Francisco under pressure from the local Israeli Council General and pro-Israel San Francisco supervisor Quentin Kopp for telling the very same story you just heard here a moment ago. Back on NPR, Scott Simon pointed out that Corbyn and Livingstone have said they are pro-Palestinian, proudly and historically, but they don't consider their opposition to Israel's policies in the Middle East as anti-Semitic. "Well, we never claimed it was," Arkush responded, "but the mural that you referred to depicted grotesquely anti-Semitic caricatures of Jews. Those caricatures came straight out of the Nazi playbook when Israel didn't exist. That has nothing to do with the conflict in the Middle East. This has everything to do with hatred of Jewish people for being Jewish. That's anti-Semitism." So Arkush had the last word, and it wasn't true. Neither Simon nor Arkush acknowledge that there are a significant number of Jewish supporters of Corbyn in the Labor Party who are not buying the anti-Semitic charge and claim it is only being raised to prevent the election in Britain of a pro-Palestinian prime minister. NPR was no better when it came to its reporting on the killing by Israeli soldiers of 17 nonviolent Palestinian protesters and wounding of another 1,500 in response to a peaceful march by Palestinians in Gaza on Friday, demanding their right to return to the homeland from which they were dispossessed in 1948. No Israelis were injured, while videos taken at the scene showed Palestinians, including a woman and a young child, shot dead in the back while retreating from tear gas. Those deaths were not accidental, according to a tweet at 1 p.m. Saturday by the Israel Defense Forces. "Yesterday," it read, "we saw 30,000 people. We arrived prepared and with precise reinforcements. Nothing was carried out uncontrolled. Everything was accurate and measured, and we know where every bullet landed, end quote. The tweet acknowledging what would be war crimes was later deleted, but not before it was captured and shared worldwide. NPR's a media watchdog group FAIR has noted throughout the years takes a default pro-Israel line when reporting on the affairs of Israel and Palestine. Its correspondents almost always live in West Jerusalem or in Israel proper, are rarely Palestinian or Arab, and they work consistently to deflect blame for Israeli violence, either shifting blame onto Palestinian victims or dispersing it through false parody. A segment from Friday's All Things Considered, as FAIR's Adam Johnson points out, provides a case study in this process. NPR host Ari Shapiro sets up the segment, an interview with reporter Daniel Estrin, by blaming the dead injured Palestinian on, quote, the militant group Hamas, framing Israel as totally defensive. From the very first line, blame is deflected from the Israeli military, in which listeners were told by Estrin they were responding to firebombs thrown by Palestinian militants. When FAIR pointed out to Estrin on Twitter that he had reported the firebombs as fact and not a claim by the IDF, he responded, "I reported the firebombs as an Israeli claim," end quote. When FAIR showed evidence he and host Ari Shapiro had done the opposite, Estrin deflected, "Be kind, it's live radio," end quote. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. As promised, we are returning to our coverage of the annual revelatory conference on the Israeli lobby, sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, which was held in Washington, D.C. in early March of 2018. Exposing the machinations of the lobby, especially AIPAC, and its inordinate influence over the U.S. President and Congress, is crucial to exposing the distortions and lies of the lobby, which have controlled American opinion on the Israel-Palestine issue for decades. This morning we hear back-to-back presentations by Professor Virginia Tilley and UN Specialist Ian Williams. Each presentation begins with an introduction.
I'm Janet McMahon, Managing Editor of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. And since April 5, 1982, when we published our first issue, we have been covering all the activities of AIPAC and the Greater Israel Lobby. So it's great to see such a wonderful turnout for our fifth conference on the Israel Lobby. And as you all know, there's a very strong wind outside today. And thank you for braving that wind. And it's a wind that I do think is blowing in our direction. So as a result of last century's two world wars, the majority of the world's countries committed themselves to the principle of international law, which was embodied in the United Nations. But adherence to that principle and to the institution has not been guaranteed, and in some cases has been outright undermined. Our first speaker, Dr. Virginia Tilley, is a professor of political science at Southern Illinois University. She earned her MA and PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and an MA from Georgetown Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. She has conducted research in Central America, Israel-Palestine, post-apartheid South Africa, and Oceania. She is the author of The One-State Solution, A Pragmatic Analysis of the Two-State Solution in Israel-Palestine, and editor of Beyond Occupation, Apartheid, Colonialism, and International Law in the Occupied Palestinian Territories. Dr. Tilley is also the co-author with Professor Richard Falk of a 2017 report commissioned by the UN's Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia titled Israeli Practices Towards the Palestinian People and the Question of Apartheid. Despite intense pressure from Israel and the U.S., the commission's chair, Rima Khalif, refused to withdraw the report and resigned in protest. The UN subsequently deleted the report from its website. Fortunately, however, we are about to benefit from the expertise which informed that report's findings. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Virginia Tilley.
Thank you very much. It's a distinct privilege to be here, especially in the somewhat daunting position of first speaker. I have to set the tone. I'm not seeing my presentation quite yet. Maybe that could go on. There we go. In this presentation, I'm not actually going to talk too much about the findings of the report. We really did write that report for a broad, informed audience of concerned people, and it is not hard to read. I think you don't have to be a legal scholar to do it. So I'm going to briefly summarize the report itself and then talk about what I think is much more engaging at this point to me, which is the implications of the report, implications for diplomacy and conflict resolution in Israel-Palestine. So I was asked first to address the question of, is the U.S. supporting an apartheid state in Israel-Palestine? Well, yes, it is, in short. It is an apartheid state. And by the way, there is no such thing in international law as apartheid state, but its practices are consistent with apartheid, and I'll come to that in a moment. But the deeper answer here is yes, and so are a lot of other people, including people who wouldn't think they are. And that's what I wanted to come to in regard to the implications of this finding for questions such as the two-state solution. Essentially, those seeking partition are endorsing an apartheid state, and that is a bit startling, so I want to get to that. And it raises this dilemma that if apartheid anywhere is inadmissible and destabilizing, it cannot comprise the basis for a just and stable peace. Now, this lifts us out of a question of whether you're pro-anybody, and simply if you're concerned about international peace and security, which apartheid is considered to be a threat to. So in this talk, again, I'm going to talk briefly about the analysis, the legal definition of apartheid, how it works, and why it requires Israel to sustain the occupation. This is a particular point I'd like to bring forth here, and then move on to the implications and why it brings us directly to the question of reunification as the only viable mode of conflict resolution. So it is based on three sources. The first is my own book that I wrote narrowly on the question of whether Israel could be expected to withdraw from the occupied territories to allow a two-state solution. The second one was this really extraordinary experience of coordinating a team of international lawyers. I'm a political scientist, not an international lawyer, through a project supported by the South African government. I believe this is on the desk out there. It is a legal analysis. Any of you who are familiar with international law should find it rewarding. Others of you might find it a bit dense. And the third one, of course, is this wonderful experience I had, a privilege of working with Dr. Richard Falk on the UN report, which was mentioned already. And a lot of what I'm going to say here came out of that report, but a lot of what's in that report relied on the previous one, Beyond Occupation. So the deeper legal analysis for the UN report is to be found there. So what is apartheid? We very briefly, the report gets into this in detail. We use apartheid very broadly. People, anything that sort of strikes us as racist or segregationist maybe elicit this term. That's perfectly fine as far as I'm concerned. We use terms anyway that are suggestive or useful for a particular analysis. But if we're going to argue that states are accountable under international law to act to end apartheid, then we must refer to the law which prescribes that obligation. That means we are brought to the relevant international law, and that is found in two major instruments, the International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid and the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. The first definition is far larger, much more detailed, but it lists a series of acts, including segregation and reserves that I'll come to. But it says that these are only acts of apartheid under certain conditions. They have to fit certain overarching conditions. And those conditions include, they may be similar to practices in South Africa. This is a universal instrument. They do not have to be exactly the same. The point is whether they seek, they have these other qualities of the law, that they are, that these are acts committed for the purpose of establishing and maintaining domination. That, I call that the purpose clause. And that it involves racial groups, that, and a systematic system of oppression, it is not just a random collection of discrete laws, but a comprehensive institutionalized system that distinguishes the apartheid. And the Rome Statute picks up on that by emphasizing, bringing in a new term, which is institutionalized regime. Political scientists get all flushed with pleasure when you talk about regimes because we have loads of theory about regimes. We start to feel a little bit more on familiar land. All these elements of the definition are satisfied in this case. The report, I refer you to the report on this. It is an institutionalized regime. It's a comprehensive system of laws that ensures Jewish national privileges. And I want to stress that hyphenated construction here, the idea that Jews are a nation and that as a people or a nation that they have this certain privileges, that it does include policies similar to South Africa, but any policy variation there would not disqualify them necessarily, but it's nonetheless quite suggestive that they do. It is a racial conflict according to international law, defining what is racial discrimination, which includes groups defined by descent. And in this case, the local construction of Jewishness and Palestinianness or Arabness is a descent groups. The key quality here which conveys special privileges to one group over another is postulations about their descent and therefore their rights to the land dating from antiquity, expressed particularly in the Declaration of the Establishment of the State of Israel, which has the status of constitutional law and Israeli law. I'm speaking kind of fast here about law, so if you're getting a little like the wind outside, it's not to worry. It's clarified in the report. And crucially, the purpose clause is satisfied, that there is this aim, this formal aim, to maintain Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. We have a cluster of laws and policies on the books to look at to confirm that Israel has that purpose, if anyone was in doubt about it. So from a legal perspective, that is satisfied as well. What was more interesting to me when figuring out what how Israel was pursuing its apartheid regime was the way it works, which is these crucial policy variations among four interwoven regimes and by the domains, which domain referring here to a territorial, a geographic entity, and a cluster of expectations, norms, rules, practices within that geographically defined ambit. The first domain being Palestinian citizens of Israel. Now, what matters here most is the right to vote, because if you're going to have Jewish and democratic state, then it becomes important not to allow non-Jews to vote those laws out. That means that you have to constrain the vote. You can allow people to vote, but you can't allow them to vote on that point. And in order to do that, you have to make sure that the non-Jewish vote is never large enough to threaten those laws. So Palestinian citizens of Israel famously do have the vote, which is often cited as the crucial difference with South Africa, but they are not allowed to vote against their own minority status. They are not allowed to vote against the Jewish national character of Israel. Palestinian residents of Jerusalem, about 300,000 people, have no national vote. They can vote for the municipal government, but not for the national government, so they are carefully excised from that potential body of voters who could challenge the Jewish national character of Israel. Palestinians in the occupied territories, of course, have no vote. They are not citizens. And they can vote for the Palestinian Authority under the terms of Oslo, but they are carefully sequestered. 5+ million people are carefully pushed out of any possibility of joining an electoral bloc that could challenge this state. And Domain 4 is the Palestinian refugees outside of the country, which outside of the territory under Israeli control, which is clearly, obviously, they don't have the vote. So another way to think of this is as a system, one regime that is effectively composed of four tailored sets of laws covering each population to achieve the same goal, which is to ensure that Israel remains a Jewish and democratic state. All kinds of arguments about whether you can be a Jewish and democratic state or a white and democratic state, I recognize that, but we don't have time to get into that now. What I would like to stress here is that this system requires that Israel maintain the occupation. Because if Israel does not keep the occupied territories under belligerent occupation, under military occupation, it faces the twin threat that a truly sovereign Palestinian state could form in those territories, which would then threaten Israel's capacity to prevent population mixing. Population mixing is the death knell for any racial state, because the neat division of populations begins to go away. When you have people mixing, they make babies and it all falls apart. On the other hand, annexation or full integration would require providing citizenship to the Palestinians, so that cannot be allowed either. Current talk about annexation is reflecting that dilemma, but it's better for Israel not to annex it. So what is the solution? Well, military occupation. So people say, well, we have to solve, we must put apartheid to one side in order to look at the occupation. I think you have that the other way around. One is the logic of occupation is following the logic of apartheid. So speeding right along, part two, implications for diplomacy. If apartheid, as it always does, it destabilizes the whole region, threatens international peace and security, it must be stopped on those grounds alone. It is morally untenable. It's a crime against humanity. It must be stopped, but how? The vision of two states is fatally flawed. My first book on the one-state solution got into this in some detail. Just from a pragmatic point of view, I really only addressed that one thing. What it does mean that we cannot anticipate that Israel will withdraw. That it's become emperor's new clothes kind of fantasy to think that will happen. I don't think that's acceptable anymore. It requires a great deal of defense, and it fails. Sustaining Jewish statehood on the part of the territory, this is the crucial thing. If you partition the land in order to allow Israel to remain Israel in one part of it and a Palestinian state to form in the other part of it, you are basically saying apartheid will continue in that part where Israel is now composed. saying Israel will continue to be a Jewish and democratic state, will continue to operate the way it is operating, will continue to be apartheid regime in a slightly different, modified border, within different borders. Now, let's my thought experiment. Transplant that I did in South Africa, it would have been okay for white South Africans to sustain apartheid in part of the country and turn over the rest of it to black South Africans. No one entertained such an idea. It was anathema. This is the same thing here. You can't end apartheid by dividing the land and allowing it to continue in another part of the land. There's other aspects of this, but cutting to the chase, I would propose, therefore, that reunification is the only way to end apartheid. And since there's so many reasons to do that, we have to take that very seriously. For activism, and by activism I mean every kind of activism, from grassroots to legal activism and diplomatic activity and so forth. If you're going to, and I just wanted to focus again on this angle of end the occupation. End the occupation is a mantra. It's a slogan. It's a sign people carry in marches. It's also a legal argument. But how? Again, Israel's withdrawal from the OPT cannot be anticipated. At best, it would be very partial. This is the Olmert plan, by the way, that you're looking at up here, where all the yellow would be Israel and the white would be Palestine, with a little umbilicus between the West Bank and Gaza. I mean, this is obviously an unviable state building. You couldn't control water. You couldn't control agriculture. You can't build a road that connects them. You can't, you know, it's unworkable. Would not end apartheid. Establish a state of Palestine to leverage withdrawal. Now, this is a very popular movement right now, big diplomatic push in the United Nations to do this. However, my point here is that if we accept the apartheid analysis that this is an apartheid regime, then such a state would be a Bantustan. It would lack the attributions of true sovereignty. Israel, as long as it is composed as an apartheid regime, cannot accept any Palestinian state that is not a Bantustan, because any truly sovereign state would threaten the Jewish national character of Israel. This means that a Bantustan state, a state of Palestine formed under these conditions, would only secure Palestinian poverty, underdevelopment, frustration, insecurity, and essentially sustain the conflict itself. I'd like to just take an extra moment here, and I'm going to destroy my time constraint, I hope not, but I will pray that a little bit of extra attention to the Bantustans is worthwhile, and I frankly encourage everyone here to Google that and spend 15 minutes looking at the Bantustans a bit more than we sometimes do. I went to South Africa to study this material because I realized I didn't understand it, and I found it fascinating as a comparison to the Palestinian Authority and the territorial and institutional constraints that it's operating under. Let's just think through the logic. Apartheid imperative, the imperative of apartheid, wherever it would appear, would be to prevent racial mixing. Okay. Otherwise, the whole logic begins to fall apart. If you can't discreetly have different populations, there's nothing to defend. In order to do that, you need strict geographic segregation. This requires that you, if you're going to actually make this work, you need separate authorities within these territories. The South Africans, interestingly, called them black self-government authorities. And guess what Oslo called them? Palestinian self-government authority. It's a great deal of conversations between Israel and South Africa about the Bantustans. It took a lot of lessons from it. I learned that from the diplomats in South Africa, by the way. This channels Palestinian or black or indigenous political aspirations to the local authority rather than to the state, to the dominant state. It's very convenient for an apartheid state to displace the frustrations and ambitions and the quest for rights of the populations dominating to their own leadership, operating under very tight constraints, of course. The pictures you're looking at on the top is a lineup of the Bantustan leaders in South Africa. In the nine, there were 10 Bantustans, but nine of these leaders were in this picture. And are below the Palestinian Authority. And by the way, I don't mean to impugn the integrity or you know, political will of any of the Palestinian Authority people. My point here is a structural one, that they are put into a position where they are compelled to act like a Bantustan authority. And the, one of the, from the point of view of the dominant state, the main function of this authority is to repress dissent, which in the top picture you see the Bantustan armed forces, in the lower part you see the Palestinian armed forces doing exactly that, maintaining the Bantustan through proxy measures. I think the battery's giving out on this thing because I'm pushing and... Oh. Let's see what happens now. Bing. There we go. All right. The Oslo Accords, we don't have time to get into this. I wrote a separate article about this, though, because I found it fascinating. The Oslo Accords established the Palestinian Authority on terms almost identical to the South African Bantustan constitutions, blow by blow. If you put those next to each other, you find almost exactly the same arrangements. And it's interesting that the ANC perceived this as a trap, rejected it from the beginning, and refused to have anything to do with it. And in fact, I understand Nelson Mandela told Arafat, bad idea, don't go for this, this is not a good idea, and they went for it anyway. That wasn't supposed to happen. A little tricky device here. So, in short, the PIA is now locked into being this self-government authority, and it cannot act independently of that role. The alternative, therefore, is if the partition can only sustain apartheid, and we must rethink the conflict on using South Africa not as a model but as inspiration or a kind of a thought experiment. They called it colonialism of a special type. It doesn't involve agreeing and admitting that a large population of people has come in and indigenized, settled, is not going to go away. Call it settler colonialism. Shift the model from a colonial to a settler colonial model. And that means that you do not end it by partition you can't end settler colonialism and its power by partition. You have to end it by eliminating settler domination. Treating Palestine as a multinational state is on the basis of race, would only perpetuate a settler discourse, because it is Zionism that is proposed that there are these identities that... then if you recognize them and institutionalize them, you're essentially perpetuating apartheid. Treat the whole country as one country, Palestine, wrongly divided by race. This was the South Africa formula. It's one country wrongly divided by race. This means reunifying Mandate Palestine. I'm out of time, aren't I? How am I doing? Okay. There is a legal basis for doing this. If we turn back to the League of Nations mandate, it always proposed that it was one country for everyone who lived there, that it would not be a Jewish state or anybody's state. It would be a secular democratic state. So there's a nice, fat legal argument to explore there. The hard part of this is that reunification does raise very serious questions of identity shifts to reconstruct the idea of the nation, reconstruct the idea of the groups. In this case, Palestine would stop being a foggy mandate reference or a dreamy future, but it would be one state that belongs to all who live in it. It would not be the exclusive geographic heritage of any one part of the population. It would not require the departure or exclusion of anybody, which is tough for people who have lost a great deal to it. Jewish has to be reconceived as an ethnic group with full civil, social, and cultural rights, not a people with superior rights to the land, not as a nation with rights to self-determination. And Palestinian, this is the toughest thing for me to say as a non-Palestinian, but it returning to the idea that it is a multi-sectarian identity. It still is, actually. Embracing everyone in mandate territory, not Arab in any sense that would exclude non-Arabs. Okay, this is one of the problems that Palestinian became Palestinian Arab state, and under conditions of settler colonialism, you can't do that without excluding non-Arabs, and therefore, unfortunately, that has to be rethought deeply. Not the racial ethnic construction affirmed by Zionism and imposed by apartheid. So that's why the apartheid finding recasts everything. That's why so many people don't want to tackle it. I think it is crucial. I think it illuminates where we are and what is going on. And the more I look at it, the more powerful an analysis I think it is. And I do hope you will consider it seriously as a model for rethinking the conflict. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker, Ian Williams, is a native of Liverpool, England, and has been the Washington Report's UN correspondent since 1991. So it's no surprise that he really knows the ins and outs of that world body. He has twice served as president of the UN Correspondents Association and has won many awards for his exposés of UN malfeasance. At the same time, he has supported and defended the UN and its ideals, and has personally known four secretaries general, as well as numerous international diplomats and officials. Ian has been a columnist for The Nation and The Guardian American Online, and an editor for the World Policy Journal. A senior analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus, he is the author of The UN for Beginners and the recently published Untold, The Real Story of the United Nations in Peace and War. And he and Dr. Tilley will be signing their books during the break that follows this panel. Please join me in welcoming Ian Williams.
It'd be difficult to follow Virginia's detailed academic expose, but it's worth remembering, one of the big problems with the United Nations is people, what's it good for? And, I'm very diffident about this. I tell people it's the worst possible organization except all the alternatives. And it does work that way. If you start off with a sense of realism about what the United Nations can do, what it stands for, then you don't get disappointed too easily and you welcome its small successes. And there are successes and they're very relevant here. And there's a very good reason why Israel and its lobby concentrate so much on the United Nations. What Kofi Annan called the unique legitimizing power of the United Nations. We've seen several results of this recently. And Israel can never get clear title of Jerusalem or the occupied territories without a UN say-so. That's key. And it's actually been proven since 1945. If you think of the occupations, East Timor, everyone had given up on East Timor. The Indonesians... I actually told the foreign minister over lunch one day, you'll never get clear title, ever, until you can get the UN to do it, and the UN won't. So they fought it to a standstill in there, but in the end, East Timor is independent. Only this week, and I don't know whether you saw this, the European Court of Justice actually ruled that the European Union had no right to sign fishing treaties with Morocco that included Western Saharan fisheries. In effect, the European Court was legitimizing boycotts of produce from occupied territories. I think that one is something that should be played up a lot more. I know it's a contentious subject, but we've pointed out several times in Washington Report that there's a separation wall in Western Sahara as well as in Palestine, that there are many parallels there. The other one, of course, is Western Sahara will, in fact, sometime, even you never see a map where it's included in Morocco. The Moroccans cannot get clear title. And it's the same with the occupied territories and Jerusalem. And this brings us back to the ambivalence of Israel and the lobby. They have, how should I put this? It's almost psychological, psychoanalysis. They have a deep respect for law. but in a sort of the Talmudic way that makes the elevator stop on every floor in the Sabbath so they can still take the elevator and obey the letter. Israel spends a lot of time trying to work its way around the laws. It very rarely completely denies them. So at the United Nations, they and the U.S. spend a lot of time trying to create the sort of Sabbath elevator so that they can skirt within the law. But they are very scared of actual definitions of the law. That's why they are so upset. If the UN were ineffectual, they wouldn't devote so much effort to thwarting resolutions in there. And take Virginia's object. There is an apartheid convention. And it's like the genocide convention. There is a legal international binding commitment on member states to do something about an apartheid state. If Israel is declared to be an apartheid state, or be practicing apartheid, there are legal consequences that states have to follow. In another regard, if you remember Jim Baker in Bosnia, and the State Department were very, very solicitous to make sure the word genocide never appeared. You know, mass murder was fine. Mass murder is something that you can ignore. Genocide has a binding legal commitment under the Genocide Convention. You have to do something about it. So, you know, it looks like we're playing with words, but this is very, very serious. And the Israelis know that. For a start, they deny it, but in effect, Israel is the only state that was actually created by a UN resolution. So you have the conundrum that they have been busily denying the efficacy of the United Nations, its legitimacy, saying that the resolutions don't apply. But their very existence depends on a resolution. You hear continually a theme that General Assembly resolutions aren't binding. And we could say, amen, because it was a General Assembly resolution that partitioned Palestine and set up the Israeli state. So, you can see you could have a whole joint conclave of Jesuits and Talmud scholars to work your way out of this particular fine print, you know, where you're denying the basis for your own existence. And it does have international complications because the United States was a founding member of the United Nations. It's still an indispensable part of the United Nations. It's inconceivable that the United Nations would exist without the United States taking part in it. And this creates severe problems because there's always the Israeli exception. Almost every law that comes, every resolution that comes up is being weighed in the balance. Nuclear non-proliferation, we saw with Grant's presentation earlier. The United States is signatory to non-proliferation treaties that say that no country apart from the five permanent members should have nuclear weapons. And then it condones nuclear weapons in Israel. And because it does that, every other country in the world, India, Pakistan, North Korea, say, hey, if them, why not us? You're continually creating exceptions to your own rules that other people walk in through. You know, the settlements in particular, the U.S. has never actually approved them, but they've changed the language so often over the years that it's as far as the U.S. is concerned, Jerusalem is international territory, the State Department. I believe, just showing this punctiliousness about law, I think I read earlier this year that the State Department is still refusing to issue passports with Jerusalem, Israel, to Americans born there. It's still Jerusalem. They won't put Israel on there. So the State Department does have some residual respect for international law that's missing from the White House completely. So let's get these territories together, because the UN is like... the UN is a sort of cockpit for all of these things. All human life is there. You're watching it. And you have this ambivalent attitude. Is most American Jews, as we know, are liberal globalists. They support democracy and freedom. They like the United Nations. They made an exception because of all this stuff about Israel and Zionism as racism. They didn't think it through, but you know, it eroded the support. And this helped erode the support for the United Nations inside the U.S. You got the people who would automatically have been natural supporters of the U.N. were always ambivalent about it. You have Jewish senators from New York looking over their shoulders who will passed resolutions condemning the UN, cutting the funds. And that's one of the points that the lobby has been doing in Washington, is to try to trim the UN to size by threatening to withhold funds, or actually withholding funds, or pulling out of organizations, as we've seen recently. And the effect of this isn't just financial. It is a continual sort of attrition of the morale and standing in the UN. We've seen secretary generals now who realize that to get on with the US, you have to pander to the Israel lobby. And all secretary generals have done this to some extent in a pragmatic political way. Kofi Annan was possibly the most accommodating up till then. Ban Ki-moon had a continual stream of the Jewish lobby organizations, B'nai B'rith, Conference of Presidents, they were coming into his office all of the time. He always received them. They were banging on the door. They were also in the UN, and they were banging on the doors of embassies. All of these funny swing states that you sort of, the microstates that only stamp collectors know about usually, will come up to support the US and Israel on these crucial resolutions. You know, the 2, 3, 6, the Pacific Trust territories, a few others. They come there, and this is a result of intensive lobbying by the Israel lobby here on these states to affect Israeli policy. At the moment, we have a particular situation coming, which is it would be almost laughable, except it's so serious. I don't know whether you know, but Israel is actually running for a seat on the Security Council this year. And, you know, on the face of it, this is laughable, but we have to remember that Morocco was on the Security Council while occupying Western Sahara. Indonesia was on the Security Council while it was occupying East Timor. Rwanda was on the Security Council while it was massacring its own population. You know, so it's not totally unprecedented. But usually they didn't actually say they're defying the whole gamut of international law openly. And is this likely to happen? I don't know. I don't want to get too much into it, but they're running for seat in the West European and Other group, which is an imperial sort of hangover, because essentially it is Europe plus the white Commonwealth, Australia, New Zealand and Canada, plus the US as a sort of ancillary member. And the Asians wouldn't have them. The Africans wouldn't have them. So in the end, intense lobbying by the lobby through the US came in and badgered the Europeans into accepting Israel as a sort of associate member so it could run for offices, which run on a rotatory basis. So Israel became a vice president of the General Assembly, became chairman of obscure committees. Would you believe the Israeli ambassador, I think, is chairman of the legal subcommittee at the moment, which is, it's like putting Casanova in charge of the chastity committee. Does not compute. But this Israeli ambassador is actually very, very concerned about this bid. Then this was upgraded very quietly so that Israel became a full member. So it was allowed to run for this. It could run for the Security Council. And the mechanics of this is, regrettably, I mean, it's good for Western Europe, but most of the countries, the Security Council seats rotate on a Buggins turn basis. You know, they have calendars going decades ahead sometimes of who occupies what position at the UN, which is why you get genocides in the Human Rights Committee, and now you might get Israel on the Security Council. And the reason for that is West Europe is the only one that actually has elections. And if they don't decide within their own group, then it goes to a general poll of all the members to who becomes a temporary member of the Security Council. So Germany and Belgium are the current candidates, and Israel is running against them. And I've been trying to sort of calculate the odds on this. It's difficult. I can imagine there are Israeli ambassadors, there are Israeli diplomats going into Berlin and saying, "You owe us so much. Why don't you do the right thing? Why don't you stand down and let us run? How could you deny us? Do you want to compound your crimes?" And the Germans will say, "Well, we'll give you another submarine. Shut up. We're taking this one," I suspect. But I am worried about Belgium. The other people will gang up on Belgium and say, you should stand down and do the right thing. Because that's the only way to get in. If it goes to an open poll, Israel isn't going to get it. But if it's done with a stitch-up like this, if Belgium is leaned upon sufficiently by the other powers, it might just do it. So it's worth watching and it's worth intervening. What's the practical effect? A lot. Discussions in the Security Council, they do end up crucial. The resolutions that come through, even a temporary member in there can have considerable effect. While France was grandstanding over the Iraq war, it was the other smaller countries with the respect for international law, like Jamaica and Ireland and others like that, who actually provided the bulk of the opposition to the Iraq war in there and stood their ground. Where do we get to with this ambassador? And I think this is where it brings the lobby in as well. Because the UN is so unpopular in some parts of America, like the evangelical Christians, or with the diehard Zionists, it's a great fundraising gamut. I keep getting letters from various organizations saying, poor little Israel, the only country not allowed to be on the Security Council. Poor little Israel, continually victimized at the United Nations, send a check. And I think it's one of the dynamics, I think Grant touched on it before, is these organizations are businesses. They're self-sustaining businesses, so they want checks off people. And if they can find an issue at the United Nations, they can raise money on the strength of it, and they do. But then it has a practical effect, because secretary generals, UN staff get pilloried, they get harassed to do the right thing. And we've seen that with the reports that have been squashed. They'll just get dropped, or they'll be sidelined. I mean, look what happened to poor Arthur Goldstone. he was personally harried into the ground until he gave up. I felt he was almost a tragic figure by the end, because he started off with such integrity. But with the US, it's even worse, because it destroys the whole basis of the United Nations. The embassy move is in direct defiance of the UN Charter. The US, the founder and drafter of the UN Charter. When the UN Charter was flown from San Francisco to Washington, the case had its own parachute. Alger Hiss, who was carrying the case, didn't have a parachute. I think maybe they knew something or suspected something. But, I mean, that was how seriously the US took the UN at the time. And this is setting at naught international law. I mean, it's being defied, but this is the significance of it. Donald Trump has basically ripped up the UN Charter. And then because we're talking about people who can believe three impossible things before breakfast, like the Red Queen in Alice, they are now saying, but Iran is in defiance of UN resolutions. Therefore, we must take action against it. Because that's the other fulcrum at the moment. The case for a war against Iran is being made in the United Nations. Our current ambassador, Nikki Haley, there, is, I mean, she should get her credentials from Tel Aviv. Not Jerusalem. Because I've never heard her say anything that isn't 150% in support of Israel. She really is. I mean, she's devoted her full time there, and she gets their pledges in. It gets down to the actual reason why the lobby is so important for these people. You want power in Washington, it goes through the lobby. You want to be president in the United States, as the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. most assuredly does, you go through the lobby. They will jump through any hoops at all to do it. And that risks they risk the organization, which, for all its faults, it's a major but pragmatic inclusion. You may look at the UN and say it's a failure, but as people in there will tell you, we haven't had World War III yet. And that's the measure. But this is the road to World War III. If you dissolve the whole structure of international global law and security, that's where we're going. And that's what Donald Trump has started, and he's done it on behalf of the lobby in there. He's done it because all across this country, people are writing checks to congressmen, persuading them to vote in defiance of international law and to vote to revile the United Nations. There are refugees who will be going very, very hungry all across the Middle East soon because Donald Trump has defunded UNRWA, which, by the way, has been doing the Israelis a favor. They've been very ambivalent. They like to revile it to keep it off, it's off balance. But you have to remember that UNRWA has been doing what Israel should have been doing as the occupying power. UNRWA has been paying for the health and education of occupied Palestinians when the occupying power should have been doing it under the Geneva Convention. So the Israelis have known this all along, and they've reviled and shouted about UNRWA, but only so far. I think they are privately probably appalled that Trump has actually followed through on their bluff and cut the funding. No, we didn't mean it, Mr. President. We want the money, honestly. We just want to keep them under control. So they have kept them under control to a large extent. They've kept Secretary General after Secretary General under control to some extent. But it still comes back to it. Ban Ki-moon had all of these people from all of the Israeli organizations coming in. But he always, once he'd been to Gaza and saw what was happening in Gaza, that was the key. The Israelis tried to stop him going to Gaza. As soon as he got there, you see all of his statements. He stated very clearly the UN positions about occupation, about Gaza. And so, yes, he kept receiving them, but then he would tell them, you've got to break the siege. You cannot keep on doing this. You've got to end the occupation. And Guterres is in the same position. He's instinctively pro-Israeli, like a lot of European social democrats. But he is now telling them, gently, you've got to. But the terrible thing is, as long as the US is 100% behind Israel, and as long as the lobby keeps it that way, then the UN is never going to be a functioning international body in a complete way, which is bad news for the world, all of us, on every level. You know, whether it's climate change or whatever. It is an indispensable organization, and I see I've entered the red light district now. So I'd better wind up. I always stay in the red light district if I can, but I'll go and sit down. Thank you very much.
To BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Is Boris the buffoon trying to start a war with Russia, or has he just been deliberately lying? Possibly the biggest diplomatic fallout since the 1960s. But who's to blame? Is it Russia or is it Boris? Have Britain's journalists got the courage to actually look within, that their own system may be at fault here? When it comes to Sky interviewing the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, which is where the Russian chemical weapons plant was, the answer is no. They recorded a 20-minute interview with him, but then they failed to broadcast it. We have an in-depth look at the Skripal scandal tonight with the news just through that Sergei Skripal's niece Victoria has been denied a visa to visit him in Britain. Why is that? Well, they think she's a spy too? Maybe all Russians are spies, eh? Our sister show Dialects back here at BCFM 93.2 at noon on Tuesdays. You can be sure to catch it online at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, LED and CFL light bulbs. Are they bad for your health? They have a very high wavelength and some people think they are. Why is it that we don't have any choice? We can't have the old incandescent light bulbs. Why is that? And Anton Vilcek, Andrei Vilcek, he's written a book about destroying the lies of the Anglo-Zionist Empire. We took talk to Andre about recent revelations that the West paid Saudi Arabia right since the Second World War to finance Wahhabism because they wanted to keep socialism out of all of the Arab countries using the Wahhabis. So we here just heard in the news there, Martin, about Victoria Skripal being denied a visa to visit the UK. Why might that be?
Well, because they're basically not following any kind of procedure here at all.
Actually, Russians generally can get visas, can't they?
Yeah.
You can come on a tourist visa, no problem. What's the problem?
Well, they're saying, well, as far as I can gather, they're claiming that she's been put up to this by the Russian government, and, you know, they're not following any procedure with any of this anyway.
The thing is, I mean, if your family is in intensive care, surely that's the first thing you want to do is to go and see if they're okay, and yet that Victoria's being told no.
Well, it's very interesting that this nerve agent, which apparently kills on immediately when you touch it, Novichok, all three of the people that were supposedly infected with it have recovered, and all of the other people that have been in contact with it, that nothing happened to them at all. And we've seen ridiculous pictures of people wandering around in chemical warfare suits. Meanwhile, police officers are wandering by with no chemical warfare suits on at all.
Martin, that's fire officers, actually, behind. Those are the people in chemical biological weapon protection suits, and stood right next to them is examining something, and stood right next to them the fireman with no protection at all.
Yes, well, it reminds me of the kind of videos put out by the White Helmets from Syria, where they claim that they're dealing with a chemical weapons attack, and in actual fact, you know, it's quite obvious it's not a chemical weapons attack, because of what they're doing, that if it was sarin, they'd all be dead because they haven't got any chemicals.
Okay, so
they haven't got the right equipment, etc.
Let's the issue of the week, which is whether or not this Novichok originated in Russia.
Well, whether there's any Novichok at all, I think, has to be a question here. Because if it was Novichok and it had been smeared on a door handle, as has been suggested, then, you know, that should have killed quite a lot of people. And immediately, they wandered off and went to a pub, a restaurant, and then they were found on a park bench. If they'd put Novichok on the door, they'd be dead straight away, wouldn't they?
Okay, well, let's just assume.
Surely.
That there was some nerve agent involved in this.
Well, that's a presumption, isn't it?
Is it from Russia?
Well, as you saw this week, the head of Porton Down, who's not actually a scientist, he used to head up Motorola. He's a PR person, but he said, "Well, actually,
well, he's a chief executive.
Well, he's a chief executive, but he's got nothing to do. He's got no scientific background.
Well, of course, he will have a scientific background working for Motorola.
No, but nothing
electronics, that sort of thing.
No, he's a very strange person to be there. I'm just pointing out, but anyway, he is their spokesperson, and of course, we've known all along that Porton Down wouldn't say that Novichok came from Russia because they've been leaking that to Craig Murray, who I believe we've got a clip of later. And so he said from the very beginning that the Porton Down scientists were not prepared to say it came from Russia. And of course, then eventually Porton Down come out and say, well, actually, we can't say it came from Russia. But by that stage, the British ambassador and Boris Johnson have already definitely said that Porton Down said it did come from Russia.
Well,
so they're lying.
Okay, well, let's have a listen now to Boris Johnson speaking on Deutsche Welle, a German channel, back on the 22nd of March. See if you think he's lying.
You argue that the source of this nerve agent, Novichok, is Russia. How did you manage to find it out so quickly? Does Britain possess samples of this?
Well, I interrogated very closely. This is a very... I mean, let me be clear with you. I wanted, when I became Foreign Secretary almost 2 years ago, one of my objectives was to try to reach out to Russia. I really did. And I went to see Sergei Lavrov in Moscow, against the advice of some people, by the way, who said it was a totally futile venture. But I wanted to, because I genuinely think Russia is an incredible country, a fantastic place, and it pains me to see the way things have got between us. And so I'm genuinely distressed by what has happened. But when I look at the evidence, I mean, the people from Porton Down, the laboratory,
so they have the samples.
They
yeah.
do, and they were absolutely categorical. And I asked the guy myself. I said, "Are you sure?" And he said, "There's no doubt." So, we have very little alternative but to take the action that we have taken.
Well, I mean, basically, he fluffed and flammed around to begin with, and then he's asked a direct question. He said that he got it from Porton Down, that they definitely had traced it to Russia.
Okay, well, let's hear
it. Porton Down then said, no, we didn't. We
okay,
didn't
well,
say
let's,
that.
Let's hear it from the horse's mouth. Gary Aitkenhead here speaking to Sky. He's the director of Porton Down.
We're able to identify it as Novichok, to identify that it was a military grade nerve agent. We have not verified the precise source, but we provided the scientific information to the government, who have then used a number of other sources to piece together the conclusions that they've come to.
Well, a number of other sources, not Porton Down, Martin.
No, indeed. And, of course, the other thing is that various organic chemists have been propping up on the internet today, saying that in actual fact, Novichok can be made by non-state actors. It's quite straightforward to make it if you want to make it.
Can anyone ever trust Boris again? I mean, not just in this country, but around the world. I mean, what sort of person, what's it like to have the British Foreign Secretary walking into the room? I mean, surely now that just means that no one will trust a word he says.
Well, that's right. He was always a very unfortunate choice to be Foreign Secretary, wasn't he? He's no Robin Cook, let's put it that way.
Well, I mean, he was also a member of the Bullingdon Club at Oxford, wasn't he? Along with David Cameron, Nathaniel Rothschild, Jonathan Ford. I mean, there's a whole list of people who, it seems, at the age of 19, 20, were told, you're going to run the country, and now they are. So they've got this whole idea that they can do and say what they want. They've got a kind of sense of impunity in these positions.
Well, it's a sense of entitlement, isn't it?
I mean, Michael Fallon, the Defence Secretary, was pressurised and forced to resign because he put his hand onto a journalist's knee. This sort of lie that Boris Johnson has told, surely that's a much more serious matter.
Well, it should be. I mean, Lord Carrington resigned over the Falklands affair because he was the Defence Secretary at the time, or Foreign Secretary at the time, and he failed to prevent the invasion, so he resigned.
That was
a different era.
Is that an extent?
You can do anything and you don't have to resign.
Is there an extent to which the Cabinet, certain members of the Cabinet, are getting isolated? It does look as if the military establishment is here, in this case, has decided that it's going to call out the Foreign Secretary and actually embarrass him.
No, I think what's happened here is the Porton Down scientists have said we're not going to be quoted in public as saying that we've found out something we haven't. And that's why they've probably put pressure on their CEO to make that statement.
There was also some discussion in that interview with Sky, with Gary Aitkenhead, the boss of Porton Down, about the possibility of there being some sort of antidote to this nerve agent.
Unfortunately, this is an extremely toxic substance. There is not, as far as we know, any antidote that you can, use to negate the effects of it.
Well, that's a fairly important thing to say there, isn't it? Because some people have said there are antidotes, and also that there are some treatments that you can give to people who've been affected by these chemicals.
Well, he says not, but at the same time, of course, all three of the people who are supposedly exposed to this deadly nerve agent have recovered.
And what about accusations that maybe this nerve agent came from Porton Down? After all, it's only 10 minutes drive away from Salisbury.
Do you know what I suspect, Tony? My copper's hunch is that there's no nerve agent. These people have all been nobbled in one way or another, so that the story of a nerve agent could then be cobbled up. And, of course, it was very, very... The timing is very important because Russia's just won... Putin's just won the presidential election in Russia. He's basically in for another six years.
It happened just before that, didn't it?
Yeah, so in other words, this is a way to mess
that
up.
Anyway, what about that idea that the nerve agent may have come from Porton Down itself was put to Gary Aitkenhead too?
What do you say to the theory that this is somehow a British operation and you've waved it out of the door?
Well, it certainly isn't anything that came from our facility because, as I said, we've got the highest standards of control and security, and there's no way that anything like that could ever have come from Porton Down. It's a military-grade nerve agent which requires extremely sophisticated methods in order to create something that's probably only within the capabilities of a state actor, and a wouldn't like to comment further on, precisely where that would be, but that's part of the ongoing investigation.
almost seemed like he was tempted to say that, and one of them might be Russia.
Yeah, but of course, in actual fact, various organic chemists have been popping up today saying, in actual fact, it's not that difficult to make it, and it doesn't have to be a state actor.
So there may
and
be...
if it is a state actor, it could be, let's put a list of it, it could be the Russians, it could be the British, it could be the Ukrainians, because of course they were part of the Soviet Union, and they had access to Soviet material, or it could be the Israelis, who've got a massive chemical weapons program, which nobody's allowed to ask any
Russians
questions
are
about.
Saying that this
and they've
is
got
all...
an interest in stirring the pot.
The Russians are saying this is all fairy tales, on Newsnight this week, a woman called Anne Applebaum from the London School of Economics popped up saying that the Russians use this as a kind of confusion tactic.
The Russians always do this. This is a tactic. You put out 1,000 different theories. It's what they did when the Malaysian airliner was shot down over Ukraine. Some of them are true, some of them are false, some of them are insane. The point is to create 12 conversations on the internet, to have RT repeat some of them, to have pro-Russian bloggers repeat some of them, and to create, in general, an atmosphere of chaos and disorganization and give people the feeling that they just can't possibly ever know what will happen. The truth is impossible to find out because there's so much noise and there's so much confusion about the whole situation.
What she's saying is, effectively, it's Russian information warfare.
Well, what she's saying is, in actual fact, she's giving the game away. This is what Cambridge Analytica and all these other people do. They come up with the narrative that the Buck missile shot down NH-17, even though you've got BBC journalists on the ground who got eyewitnesses saying that they saw a Ukrainian plane shoot
down.
So
you're saying that she's saying that she's accusing the Russians of what actually the West is doing?
Well, exactly. What RT, and as you know, I'm a regular on RT, what RT is trying to do and the Russians are trying to do is actually play a straight bat. It's the West that comes out with all of these various theories about this, that and the other. And of course, it's always their theory that's, you know, if the British government secret services say we had nothing to do with it, well, that's the end of it. I mean, if the British secret services say they had nothing to do with it, and they are our secret services after all, and they never lie, not because British secret services never lie, therefore it must be the Russians. I mean, it's this childish stuff. In actual fact, what RT does and what we're doing now is we're going through the various theories which the governments have come up with, and we're seeing which ones are more credible. And of course, if you look at what happened in Syria, the chemical weapons attacks in Syria, which nearly led us to a war in Syria, all the evidence suggests that they were carried out by Al-Qaeda rebels supplied with sarin from Libya by our intelligence services.
Now, this is interesting because we've also had more evidence recently that there's been chemical weapons floating around in Syria, not necessarily on the Syrian government side either. And what might be the purpose of those?
Well,
and what evidence
Before the Skripal affair occurred, the Russian general staff issued a statement saying that they had information that rebels were going to stage a chemical weapons, a supposed chemical weapons attack in Syria, similar to the ones they've done before, which would then be used as an excuse for an all-out assault on the Syrian armed forces and their Russian allies.
By whom?
By NATO. By us. Yeah, and we've been killing Russian personnel in Syria for quite a while now. The RAF were involved in the attack at Deir ez-Zor that killed 80, 90 Syrian army guys. Now, what they did is they managed to capture the chemical weapons factory in Idlib, and they even showed people, look, this is a chemical weapons factory that Al-Qaeda had been running. But, of course, what people like Anne Applebaum will say, and she's a neoconservative in US terms, is, oh, well, the Russians do this just to confuse everything. In actual fact, what's really going on is Cambridge Analytica and SCL or whatever it was that was the core. They actually went to Dicey, the military exhibition, some years ago, and their pitch to the punters was, we could stage a fake chemical weapons attack in London, and then you could do all the things you need to do on the back of that, but we could make it look real and everybody would believe it was real. And that's what they were selling to the government's people there as what they could do for them.
So
and what's happened
is this
psychological
actually,
warfare stuff has become completely absurd.
This is, it's not absurd, it's extremely dangerous and powerful. Do you think that's possible to stage an attack in London and convince everybody
that's what they were saying to the punters. Now, in actual fact, what's happened with the empowerment of psychological warfare and PR in the West is that they really do believe that they can mould people's minds by feeding them snippets of information, watching them on Facebook, isolating the people that they don't like and making them sound as if they're crazy, like Craig Murray's, as happened to Craig Murray, and so on. And then you've got all of these kind of non-entities like Anne Applebaum, who's really basically got no qualifications to speak what whatsoever, who then come out with all this. We know what the Russians are doing.
Why have Sky interviewed Craig Murray? And his, actually being from Uzbekistan is fascinating because that's where the Russian chemical weapons plant was.
Yep.
And then just simply not broadcast the interview.
Because Sky is controlled by Rupert Murdoch. And Rupert Murdoch's son today was saying that the intelligence service in Britain have definitely found the secret lab that the Russians... The Russians have got to have a secret lab to produce this stuff because, of course, they actually dismantled their chemical warfare capability. We're supposed to have dismantled our chemical warfare capability. If a straightforward question to Porton Down is, why are you still there? The Russians dismantled their equivalent a long time ago. Fort Detrick in Maryland was definitely the source of the anthrax, which killed six people after 9/11. Has it been closed down? No, it hasn't. And in actual fact, the Bulgarian journalist, of name I've forgotten, has uncovered the fact that they've got chemical warfare labs all over the world. And that's what the Western powers do. They accuse other people of being into chemical warfare. And you know who's into chemical warfare? NATO.
Appropriately, that's from 1994, Stranglers and Skin Deep. Now, Martin, we also had last night at the United Nations Security Council some quite serious conversations between the three main participants were Vasily Nebenzia, he's the Russian permanent member on the UN Security Council, Karen Pierce, I've never heard of before in my life, she's representing us, 60 million Britons, and also Kelly Curry from the United States. The UN Security Council, I know that you mentioned briefly last week that you think there may be attempts to get Russia removed from there.
Well, the British side have already said that, you know, the goal is to get removed the Russians from the Security Council, which, of course, is, you know, the Russians are really, you know, they're not going to be removed from the Security Council because the Chinese will never stand for it.
Is the UN any value anyway at the moment?
Well, the problem with the UN system is it's been the Russians are actually quite keen on building up the UN, but the problem is that it's been subverted by the West. So that when the UN does what the West wants, they're quite happy to push the UN line. But when things like the Israelis totally disobey the UN, or things that happen, which the invasion of Kosovo or Libya, which has not actually been agreed by the UN, then
or Iraq.
Or Iraq, that's right. Then it's coalitions of the willing and therefore and all the rest of it. The fact of the matter is that the Western powers play within the rules until they're losing, and then they say it's our baton, it's our ball, and we're not playing anymore. For example, one of the things they did was exclude Russian UN diplomats as part of their kicking people out thing. The whole point of having the UN in New York is it's not actually up to the Americans to decide who is going to be a diplomat at the UN, but they've just taken no notice of that and kicked the Russians out anyway because it's on US soil. Maybe it should be moved to Geneva or somewhere. That's possibly one answer.
Let's have a listen to some of the things said at the UN Security Council last night. First of all, Kelly Curry, who's the United States representative there.
Yet another attempt by Russia to use this Security Council for political games.
Games?
Well, I mean, the Russians called the meeting. So, in a sense, they could, you know, they're trying to use the UN Security Council to do what the UN Security Council is supposed to be there for.
This whole idea of games, though. I mean, are we maybe looking at game theory here? The idea that actually anything goes so long as you win at the end of the day? The truth is kind of sidelined?
That's right. And that's the whole psychological warfare mindset that the West has got itself into. They accuse RT, for example, of being propaganda when RT effectively is trying to get to the truth as they see it.
Oh, come on. RT is Russian propaganda, just as the BBC's British propaganda.
But the point is it's actually on a different level. People like Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson's dad are all on RT. And of course, if they'd interviewed Craig Murray was interviewed on RT, but he wasn't interviewed on Sky.
He's agreeing with the Russian point of view. Yes, I know. Look, what you're getting is you're getting a division across journalism now in the world where a channel represents a particular national interest rather than balance across all views.
Yes, but they've all got to work within the concept of balance. Now, in actual fact, Sky...
They don't bother with balance, Martin. They really don't.
I would suggest to you, as somebody who works for RT, is that they're actually pitching they actually make a point of trying to put the other side's point of view, which is what the other side don't do. And that's the right tactic from their point of view.
Have you heard
the other side
any
are made
criticism,
to look stupid.
Have you heard any criticism of Putin on RT?
I've made criticisms of Putin myself on RT, and I've done it. And nobody shut me off, and I keep coming back.
That's good to hear. Well, I did, and I was kicked off.
Yeah, but I mean, you've got your own reasons for saying what you say, and I've got my reasons for saying what I say.
I don't think many people can deny that unless it's actually in that direct. I mean, for example, in Ukraine and the conflict there, you've got very different opinions from the Western media and from the Russian media, but you get a fairly balanced view from somewhere like Al Jazeera, who's actually out of that particular fight.
Well, not entirely, because Al Jazeera is run by...
I was looking at the coverage at the time. Al Jazeera was giving both sides. I mean, obviously, in the Israel-Palestine situation, it doesn't really give both sides. No. But, it seems to me that many of these mainstream media outlets around the world are absolutely getting tied up with conflict with another... mindset.
If you really want to discuss this, and I don't know how much time we've got. The point is that you've got various levels of this. You've got national media like RT, like BBC, like Al Jazeera, which operate on a different level, frankly. They are more objective. And then you've got Sky News and Fox News, which are just privately run propaganda.
Okay. Now, let's have a listen to the next person on the UN Security Council. Another short clip here, and this is our very own Karen Pierce. And please do leave a link on our show page at thisweek.org.uk if you know anything about her, because I've never seen her before at all. And here she is representing us on the UN Security Council last night.
We have nothing to hide, Mr. President, but I do fear that Russia might have something to fear.
States and
I think the metaphor that I find most apt is that of an arsonist turned firefighter. But in this particular instance, the arsonist wishes to investigate his own fire.
Well, that's just the sort of thing they're going to say. As Mandy Rice Davis would say, they would say that, wouldn't they?
And so let's have a listen also now to Vasily Nebensia. Actually, it's a very long session, but I thought I'd just take a few clips to give you an idea of the flavour of what some of the representatives were saying at the UN. And afterwards, Martin, we'll decide if the UN is really any point or value to it anymore.
Gentlemen,
ladies and gentlemen, I don't even know what to say about this. It's some sort of theater of the absurd. Couldn't you come up with a better fake story?
Well, I mean, the Russians are quite clear that they suspect that this is all part of Operation Beluga, which was grassed up by a French anti-terrorist officer some years ago, which is basically...
We talked about that on last week's
show.
Yes,
an ongoing campaign to denigrate Russia and undermine them because they are a threat to Western interests.
Well, one of the voices
that's the bottom line.
We've really not heard much of, although he's been blogging about it, is Craig Murray, former British ambassador to Uzbekistan. He resigned on principle over him sending messages back to the Foreign Office saying that some of the intelligence being sent back but to the Secret Services had been obtained under torture and that he didn't believe it was reliable. And because they were actually then using that information as if it was reliable, he resigned on principle. But anyway, let's have a listen to him now. And here he is talking on RT because, of course, we cannot have access to the interview, the 20-minute one he did with Sky, because they won't broadcast it. Anyway, what he's pointing out here in our first clip is that actually this was his story, the idea that that the Novichok nerve agent, whether it was used or not, but whatever, it came from Russia. He proved, and he said, well, they haven't actually got any evidence of that because I've heard it from my sources in the Foreign Office. So, in a way, this week's story has really been Craig Murray's story, and yet we haven't seen him interviewed on our London media.
I published on my blog a fortnight ago that sources within the Foreign and Commonwealth Office had told me that Porton Down scientists were unable to say it was made in Russia and that they were under very heavy pressure from the government to say that, and they were refusing to say it. And today it's been confirmed that my sources were telling me the truth. What we've seen today is news management, because the government had to get over the hurdle that the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons would shortly be telling people that there is no evidence this came from Russia. And obviously the government decided from the point of view of damage limitation that it was best that Porton Down came out and said that first, and so that they could try to manage the news story. And we'll see very careful news management over the next day or two.
Well, that's right. I mean, he had contacts inside Porton Down and in the Foreign Office who were telling that they haven't got evidence that it's from Russia. And then the Porton Down scientists probably put their foot down and that's what they've done. But they're trying to spin the fact that they were trying to lie.
The point here is that they've got the diplomatic expulsions that they wanted now. So it doesn't really matter what the truth is now.
No, it does. It does. You see, but what they want to do is move along now. We're talking about diplomatic expulsions and et cetera. And we all know that the Russians did this. And what the Russians are doing is saying, no, we're going to come back and we're going to talk again and again and again about what you claim happened in Salisbury, because these three people have recovered, and if it was Novichok they'd all be dead.
And
that's just a logical point which we're going to keep banging you over the head with.
And what about this idea that only state actors could create this?
Well, various chemists have been on it.
Martin, can you just let me finish? Yeah. What about the this idea that only state actors could create this Novichok chemical? Let's see what Craig Murray's got to say.
An absolute minimum of a couple of dozen states which could make this. But he said probably it would need a state to manufacture it. And I think that probably is very important, because there are many other people, including, for example, the David Collum, professor of organochemistry at Cornell University, who says that it's just not true. It has to be a state, and any of his students, his senior students, could make it. It's also very, very interesting If you watch the interview, the sentence where he says it would probably need a state to make it is tacked on at the end, and it's very discontinuous from the rest of the interview. And if you look closely, you'll see that not only has the shot changed, the camera and tripod have actually been moved. So I strongly suspect that the government handlers, who would definitely have been in that room watching him, were unhappy with his interview, wanted something that implicated Russia a bit more, so they added on a bit at the end after it all finished and the camera had been moved, saying it was probably a state actor.
Well, there you have the manipulation that goes on. And it's not manipulation by the Russians, it's manipulation by the British. Perfidious Albion.
So why is
plenty
it
of
that
people around the world don't believe
why
this,
is it, why is it that people like Craig Murray are just simply not interviewed?
Well, I mean, you may well ask. He was interviewed, but they haven't used
but
it.
That's only on because, RT.
Yeah, but he was interviewed by Sky, and they didn't use it. And that's because Sky is propaganda, and RT is less so.
OK, so let's have a listen now to Craig talking about Uzbekistan, because, of course, that's a country he knows very well, and it's also where the the Soviets had their at least one of their most important chemical weapons plants, which was dismantled. See what Craig Murray's got to say about that.
Chemical weapons testing facility was in Nukus in Uzbekistan. It was actually dismantled by the Americans between 1999 and 2002. I attended a farewell party for the Americans when they'd finished, and I've actually visited the establishment after it was all dismantled. But all the lab notes and the equipment and stuff went to the United States, so they can certainly manufacture it. Of course, there were many Ukrainians, for example, working at Nukus who worked on Soviet chemical weapons programs. It was a Soviet facility, not a Russian facility, and pretty well every nation you can name of the former Soviet Union has people with the ability to do this, not to mention the fact that other countries have quite openly done it. One thing that's interesting is that the head scientist at Porton Down, when asked whether or not the substance could have come from his laboratory, he didn't say, no, we don't manufacture that substance or we don't make anything like this. He said, no, it could not have come here from here because our security and controls are extremely tight. That's more or less an admission they do manufacture this kind of thing. And as I say, the number of states and probably non-state actors too who could make it are extremely large.
Well, I mean, as I said last week, Martin, I've had it confirmed with me from an army officer that worked at Porton Down that they definitely do have samples of Novichok there.
Well, indeed. And, of course, what this increasingly looks like is a psychological warfare operation by MI6. That's, if I was a Wiltshire police officer, that would be first on my list of suspicions.
What about the role of this Orbis Business Intelligence? Because Skripal was working with them, Sergei Skripal, as well as Christopher Steele, who wrote the Trump dossier, and Pablo Miller, who apparently was the handler at MI6 for Skripal.
Yeah, so in other words, there's a link here with the so-called Russiagate scandal in the US, whereby MI6, because Steele was an ex-MI6 officer, but there's no such thing.
Is this
thing
a sort of
really
privatised version of MI6?
Yes, well,
it?
I mean, that's what's happening all over. There's no line of command anymore. What you've got is a subcontracting.
But MI6
scenario.
Will do this for deniability's sake,
well, exactly,
as well, surely.
Exactly.
They can say it's nothing to do with us. Nothing
that's
goes
right
in the public records
right
office about this. This is just a little private.
That's right.
Contract.
Well, and if MI6 were to take some Novichok from Porton Down and use it for a psychological warfare operation, nobody else but them would know what they were doing.
I mean, what's the implication of privatising this kind of thing?
Well, what the implication is A, it gives them plausible deniability when they get caught out, so they can say, oh, there's nothing to do with us, like the American officer that was caught, or was it, they've got evidence that he orchestrated the snipers in the Maidan Square in 2014, because that came out in the court case in Kiev. And the other thing, of course, is it allows penetration of the state apparatus by powerful groups.
But I mean, surely this sort
by
of thing,
billionaires,
surely, Martin,
and oligarchs.
This sort of thing would be impossible to cover up.
What sort of thing?
Well, this kind of operation you're talking about. I mean, everyone would know about it.
Listen, this kind of scam is the bread and butter of NATO intelligence services going back decades. There have been, you know, the assassination of Aldo Moro, the bombing of Bologna Railway Station, the Dortmund Beer Hall Massacre, the whole Gladio network. This was them. And it's the police investigation has shown that this was NATO intelligence service. NATO intelligence services engage in deception, disinformation, terrorism and assassination. That's their stock in trade, and it has been for years.
Get into the Illuminati, cause we wanna get invited to the coolest parties. By subtly communicating hidden symbology, soon we'll be part of a secret society. Hollywood will open up its doors for us. We'll meet the inner circle of executives. We'll give a guy Rusty in a warm jacuzzi, and the guy will put us in a Disney movie. Then they'll play a music on MTV. We'll be given designer clothes for free, and we can drive everywhere DUI, cause we'll be under the protection of the all-seeing eye. And we'll never have to worry about bills again, cause the Rockefeller family will be our best friends. We'll fuck a squirrel and finger a fish, and triangle, eye, pyramid. You can be rich and famous too. I love the establishment, yay! We want to get into the Illuminati, and we want to hang out with Jay-Z and Beyonce. We want to sell our souls in a billion records and bow before our reptilian overlords. Then the enlightened few will bring us into the fold, where we'll be told secrets of old, like why the CIA killed JFK and why on Earth the moon landing was fake. Being Illuminati will be semi-formal, and the truth about Area 51. They'll tell us where Flight MH370 is and which politicians like to fuck kids. We'll get a million followers on Instagram. We'll have the whole wide world in our hearts. The Rothschilds will take us to Bohemian Grove, where it's likely that we'll both be murdered and claimed. Let's manipulate the economy. War is good for humanity. We'll be given the keys to unlock the Bible, and we'll become Lucifer's loyal disciples. We'll pray to Baphomet and the princes of hell. We'll bathe in pig's blood and cut ourselves under the blood moon, beneath Saturn's radiant energy, before the Dark Lord Lucifer himself. I invoke the four crowned princes of hell, inviting the forces of darkness to bestow their knowledge and power upon me. I, your faithful servant, promise to hide triangles in things, perform at the Grammys and tell people the earth is round. From this day forth, I'll do whatever it takes to thwart globalism, multinational corporations, the establishment and the military-industrial complex. I love fracking, it's the best. Let's go for some pizza.
What flavor?
Kitty flavor. We're gonna get assassinated for making this video.
More like initiated.
That is a sort of Mickey take of the secret societies, but actually, at the end of the day, there are networks, aren't there, of former intelligence officers, agents, and that sort of thing that do actually still operate.
Yes, they do, and I think also the creation of a jokey version of what they do is part of their intelligence disinformation.
It's a kind of criminal market as well. I mean, things like the Pinay Circle, they are, have been said anyway, to be a kind of operational arm of unofficial private power, like in the NATO countries.
Well, the fact of the matter is that people in power are, you know, the oligarchy in the West and in Russia, in fact, they do get together and they do plot and plan, and they suborn secret services to do what they want to do. It's a question of understanding it. I mean, I sometimes feel like saying, well, there was no war in Northern Ireland. It's just a conspiracy theory. Nothing happened. Nothing was blown up. Nobody was killed. It was all just made up in order to try and, it's conspiracy theory to suggest anything happened at all.
Actually,
and of course, in reality, there was a war, and in reality, there is conspiracies out there,
and
all sorts of things
are going on.
We're
just about to hear about those conspiracies written in a book, and it's called Rise and Kill First by Ronan Bergman. The first clip we're going to hear from him is when he talks about going from being in the Mossad and Shin Bet to being Prime Minister. The idea here being that the man that comes to the Prime Minister and says, we would like to assassinate this person, will you please sign off this operation, then after a few years becomes the Prime Minister himself.
The chief of the Mossad, the chief of the Shin Bet, the Israeli domestic secret service, coming to the Prime Minister to convince him. This is usually happening in his private house. the house of the Prime Minister in Balfour Street in Jerusalem, because it's so secret. Now, of course, the chief of the organization, whoever he is updated with the details, but he's not updated with the small the tiny maneuvers of the coming action. So he's bringing with him the intelligence officers and the operatives. Now, these are very young people. We are talking about people, most of them under the age of 30. Some of them under the age of 35. This is how the Israeli system works. They bring the PDF and the Adobe Acrobat presentation, and they are trying to convince the Prime Minister. Just imagine the drama in that forum. And also, throughout time, some of these people, the young officers, who were there to convince the Prime Minister to issue an assassination of someone because he's bad enough and he's planning to kill Jews tomorrow. Some of these people crossed that room during time and became the Prime Minister. Ehud Barak, Benjamin Netanyahu, Moshe Yaelon, the Israeli former Minister of Defense. Moshe Yaelon was the person who pulled the trigger himself on the head of Abu Jihad, Khalil al-Wazir, Yasser Arafat deputy in Tunis in 1988. Now, you come to think, or you come to wonder, what does the profound involvement, not in knowing, not in sending people, but the actual having the enemy head on your hindsight and pulling the trigger, what does it do to your mindset when you become a prime minister?
Well, Israel is a warfare state run by the secret services.
The idea that these military people then, you know, it's almost like a kind of graduation. So you've done a few successful assassinations. Now we're going to make you prime minister.
Well, that's right.
So also Ronan Bergman talks about the idea that Israel is the best secret service in the world.
Arguably, Israeli intelligence is indeed the best intelligence community in the world. No offense to the American or the French. You know, Tim Weiner wrote a book, Pulitzer winner, Legacy of Ashes, about the CIA. And he describes a history of failures. My book does not describe a history of failure. On the contrary, Israeli intelligence, sooner or later, was able to come with solution to most, if not all, the tactical problems that the Israeli leader presented to it. There were botched operations, we can discuss them later, but at the end of the day, this is a story about success. But in that success are also the grains and the problem. Because Israeli leaders came to the conclusion that at the tip of their fingers, they have this powerful tool where they can order to take out a building, a computer, or a human being way beyond enemy line. And they thought it's not just enough to use that to save, you know, people tomorrow from the next suicide bomber, or to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear bomb by killing one of their scientists, or more than one. But they thought this is a powerful tool that can be used to stop history, to hold it by its tail. And therefore, the story in the book is a story of unbelievable series of tactical successes of the Israeli intelligence community, but also of a disastrous strategic political failure from these politicians who thought it's enough to have these tools and not turning to statesmanship, political discourse, diplomacy, and compromise.
So what does he mean there when he says that actually the operations were a success, but the fallout has been a failure in many cases?
Well, he's making the point that because they've got this tools, as he describes it, the politicians then feel that they just can rely on the tools. But I would also say this, that when the Israelis like that claim that they are a very good intelligence service, better than the CIA or whatever, why did you write a book telling us all about it? The problem with Mossad and Shin Bet is they can't help but boast about what they do. And in actual fact, all of the stuff they did, like the assassination of Abu Jihad, that was illegal. And those who did it should be in prison. But they're not. They're patting themselves on the back.
All secret services do this, surely, Martin. Anyway, I also asked him about censorship and whether the book had been censored by the Israeli intelligence services.
Security officers tend to be very tough, very rigid, very hard to deal with. The question, I think, is not whether to publish or not publish something that harms Israeli security and spill its secret. I think no one would like to do that. Maybe the Iranians would like, but it's not a common interest by us or by Random House or by anyone else. The question is, how do you define state security? You know, in 1965... maybe I said something that about censorship. According to Israeli press, has to be going through censorship prior to print. According to an old British law that the Brits legislate to their colonies and Israel absorbed when was established in 1948. So we, the Israeli journalists, the Israeli press, the Israeli media, are giving to censorship, to prior scrutiny, everything that we publish on national security, military, intelligence, oil, and the Middle East. So in 1965, one of the famous Haaretz columnists, Yoel Malkus, wrote something in the line that the chief of staff is not very smart. Censorship took it out. They banned that from being published. They said this is a military secret. And that if the enemy would know that the chief of staff is not very smart, then he might take an action. So, and they were serious. You know, we treat this as a joke now, but they were deadly serious at that time. War crimes. Would they be seen as state secret? Now, the state would see them as a secret, but I don't think that they are a secret. And et cetera, et cetera. So we have, being an Israeli correspondent, I have a weekly, sometimes daily negotiation and argument with the Israeli censorship. They have added many, many, many deletions, and we have been struggling with them when coming to publish the book. But let me tell you this. At the end of the day, I think that Rise and Kill First is able to supply its reader a complete, or at least close to complete, picture of the narrative, the world, and the broader lesson that I was trying to bring. I was not intending to put anything that could jeopardize modus operandi or name of sources.
So, Martin, what he's saying there is that pretty much all printing and media is censored in Israel, and that's a legacy of the Brits.
Yeah, and what do you think, it isn't censored here? I mean, look at what's happened about this Skripal case. Various puppets have been told to say what they've been told to say, and, you know, we're being fed a line, just the same as in Israel.
Okay. Also, is killing leaders a good idea? Somebody in the audience asked Ronan Bergman that.
There were many, many cases where the operation was successful, but it led to a catastrophic result. The attempts to kill leaders, most of them... have changed history, but not to the it did not take the same course as the planners thought. In February 1992, the first assassination that involved drones in history, Israel killed the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Hossein Abbas Mousawi. Now they thought he's the leader of a terrorist organization. They have the opportunity to kill him. Why don't do it? They killed him, only to get, instead of him, getting Hassan Nasrallah, who's by far more talented, capable, radical, who changed the priority of Hezbollah, and instead of focusing on internal Lebanese politics, he focused on Israel. And they got 40 days afterward, the bombing of the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires, which basically rewrite the rules of the game between Israel and Hezbollah, when Hezbollah said, if you are hurting us in Lebanon, we will take out a Jewish target, and you cannot defend all Jewish targets worldwide all the time. We will take it out in a remote place of the world. And Israel, for many, many years, because of taking the embassy and then the Amia building in Buenos Aires, Israel refrained from killing Hezbollah leaders for many, many years.
Well, this guy is an intelligence journalist, and of course he's also in involved in misinformation, because the attack upon it was an Israeli Jewish center, it's a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires. It wasn't the Israeli embassy, and a lot of evidence suggests that it was in fact carried out by Mossad as part of trying to make Hezbollah look bad. Hezbollah never claimed it and never took a responsibility for it.
But he may simply not know that, you know.
Well, he may not know that. What you've got to remember is that people only know what they know, and they don't know what they don't know, and they also may be deliberately misleading you, because as he rightly said, and he's quite clear about that, I'm not doing anything which will undermine
one of the most
Israeli security.
Interesting.
So we know what side he's on.
One of the most interesting revelations for me in the book was the idea of having a whole bunch of intelligence Mossad hit squad disguised as a crew from Fox TV.
The real stories of that unit featuring some of the chapters of the book, one of them of how they disguised themselves, not as Arabs, but as an ABC team. And they kidnapped one of the most wanted Arab terrorists. And when his family called the day after to ABC office in Jerusalem to say, where is our son? They said, we don't know. We weren't there. And that caused a political problem for the state of Israel when the chair of ABC called the Prime Minister Shamir.
So the worst they get is a phone call from the chairman of ABC, sorry, not Fox. But that is a pretty underhand method, isn't it?
Well, it then leads to a situation where news crews doing their job are basically going to be treated as Israeli intelligence agents, and they might end up dead. But the Israelis don't care because they haven't got any rules or morals. What about, in actual fact, they break the UN rules all the time.
What about the idea of having retribution from other states? If you're going to start taking out their leaders, maybe they might do the same to you.
What would happen if another intelligence agency would react and try to start assassinating Israeli officials as a revenge for what Israel has done? That's the question?
Correct.
Okay. Well, it happened. In the 70s, the PLO reacted fiercely to the fact that Israel was trying to kill its operative. They had redoubled some of the double agents that the Mossad was operating. They exposed some of the Mossad double agent and convinced them to turn again and kill the case officer from Mossad who was running them. And so Mossad was under attack as well. But Israel was by far more advanced, more organized, and more strict. And so the attempts to revenge were not very, very successful and were addressed by severe force. The Iranians have tried to revenge both the assassination of the nuclear scientist and more, the assassination of Imad Mournia by the U.S. and Israel in Damascus in 2008. Israel intelligence has counted so far 27 attempts to revenge Mournia's life. And except for one in Bulgaria, when they exploded a bus of Israeli tourists, they failed in all of them. One Israeli operative told me the main reason why there was not even one successful, effective attempt to revenge for Mournia's life is the fact that Imad Mournia is no longer here to revenge his death. Because he was a genius. He was very, very capable. But it's not just that. Israel, what made the last 15 years more successful from the point of view of Israel than previous times against Iran and Hezbollah, Hamas, and the other jihadist movements, is that it's not just the Israeli ability to execute, but also prepare for the countermeasures that would be taken by the other side in the day after. The Israel was prepared, and their intelligence penetration into the rank of Iran and Hezbollah is superb.
The other thing that's been said by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman this week, Martin, to the Washington Post, or possibly it was last week, was he was accusing the West of being behind Wahhabism. He said, well, this was the deal which was done at Bitter Lake at the end of the Second World War, is that the Americans said that they, and the British said that they wanted, well, actually it was just Roosevelt, I think, at that meeting, said that they wanted to have this radical jihadi movement, radical Islam of killers that would take out the socialists that were around in the Arab world, and there were quite a lot of them at the time. They were worried about the rise of communism and socialism within the Arab world, including places like Indonesia, which people often forget is a massively important Islamic state.
Well, yes, and I think the fact is we're getting a partial view from this guy who's written this book. The bombing in Bulgaria, I think the evidence suggests again that was a Mossad bombing. They're quite capable of killing Jews in order to make their enemies look bad.
And finally,
the image they present of themselves as these kind of ninja geniuses is simply not the
final
case.
Word, brutal, final word on the situation brutal. In Gaza: 7 dead, 25 in hospital, lives threatened, and 300 wounded by Israeli gunfire.
That's today, isn't it? Well, this is just, and I want to see the people accusing Jeremy Corbyn of anti-Semitism. I want to hear them speak out about this. And if they're not prepared to speak out about it, I'm not really prepared to listen to them.
Okay, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 8. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today, with guest co-host Ken Burrows from San Francisco State University. On today's program, we look at the plot to kill King, the truth behind the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., which is also the title of the latest book from national best-selling author Dr. William Pepper. William Pepper joins us for the program today to talk about his most recent book on the plot to kill King. Please stay with us.
Created by criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with special guest co-host Ken Burrows from San Francisco State University. On today's program, we have the distinct pleasure of joining in conversation with the national best-selling author, Dr. William F. Pepper. William Pepper is a human rights lawyer most known for his defense of James Earl Ray in the trial for the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. and of Sirhan Sirhan in the trial for the murder of Senator Robert Kennedy. Pepper is the author of An Act of State and Orders to Kill. He has been active in government cases, including the 9/11 Truth Movement, and in attempts to charge George W. Bush with war crimes. He was appointed a barrister of the United Kingdom, but now primarily resides in New York. His latest book on Skyhorse is called The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And William Pepper, you join us today by phone. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Mickey and Ken.
Hello, Bill. Welcome. Nice
to
meet
you, Ken.
Let's start with your connection with Dr. King. How and when did you first come to meet Dr. King, and really, what sort of a man did you find him to be?
Well, I only knew Martin King the last year of his life, and I met him in early 1967 as a result of him having read and apparently been deeply moved by my piece in Ramparts magazine in January of 67 called The Children of Vietnam. So he had asked me to meet with him and discuss the horrors and the war crimes that I encountered in Vietnam when I was there as a journalist, and I did that. Then he asked me to stay with him as long as possible, work with him as much as possible on the formation of what we came to call the National Conference for New Politics. It was an umbrella organization designed to bring together peace and freedom entities from all over the country under one roof for the purpose of opposing the war, but also for beginning to deal with the issues of economic injustice. He was increasingly concerned about the impoverishment of large numbers of Americans and wanted to go into that area as well. Neither of these topics, the war or the economy, endeared him to the ruling forces of American society. And indeed, not only did it not endear him, but they came to have contempt and disdain for him. When he delivered his anti-war speech at Riverside Church on the 4th of April, 1967, 1 year to the day of his death, the next day, he was condemned across the country by virtually every newspaper, and even members of his own civil rights movement and various groups there criticized him, condemned him. In some instances, he was called a traitor. So I came in to meet him at that period of time as a result of his evolutionary development with respect to seeing the links between war and poverty as it affected not only Native Americans, Mexican Americans, Appalachian whites, and Southern blacks, but as it affected all of the poor people of the world. So he was growing, and I came upon him at that point in time. Now, what kind of a man was he? A man of enormous courage. No matter how much money it cost him, his organization, matter how much his life became increasingly endangered, he stood firm on behalf of values that he thought were essential, human values. And he thought to be silent in the face of this type of criminality, war criminality in particular, was in fact unconscionable. So he was a man of enormous courage, depth, and integrity, and determined to have an impact on the structure of American democracy.
And so part of what you may have been talking about is organizing the Poor People's Campaign, is that right? And also, how did you influence his anti-war position, and what was your relationship with King during that time?
Well, the Poor People's Campaign was very much developed during that point in time, but it had been an idea of his that was generated somewhat before in 1966. But it related to the economic issues that I just mentioned. With respect to the war, I was traumatized personally by the amount of devastation and brutality and slaughter that I saw over there, and tried to convey that in the Ramparts piece. And when I showed him, opened to him the rest of my files I had developed, he openly wept. We were on the way to open Vietnam summer in Cambridge, Massachusetts, following a sermon of his at Brown University Chapel, and that's where I met him for the first time. I waited until he came out, and then we rode together. And he wept when he saw what his government was doing to this ancient, beautiful people. So he was deeply moved and determined, at great risk, not just monetary risk, but great physical risk, to stand against that war.
Your conclusions that you reached regarding his assassination, what led up to that?
Well, they had determined they were going to kill him because of the two issues we've just been discussing. The war was a very important monetary issue for major American corporations. You know, at one point, John Downey, who was head of the Military Intelligence Group, the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, used to brief Johnson, President Johnson, on a very regular basis. And every time he would come back from Vietnam, he would brief the president, and he would ask him, why are we there? Why are we losing blood and treasure? What's behind all of this? What is the reason for it? Doesn't make any sense. And Johnson would ignore him for the most part. And then finally one day, I guess he'd had too much or whatever, he pounded the table and he said, John, I can't get out of Vietnam. My friends are making too much money. So that, to me, says it all in terms of the reason for waging war. It was corporate interests, okay? That was very important. So the war was a very important reason for wanting to get rid of him. But the Poor People's Campaign, in my view, is probably the major reason, because he was going to bring 500,000 people to the nation's capital, and they were going to camp there. They were going to go visit their elected representatives, and they were going to try to get agreement to turn the funds back again to programs of social welfare and social justice. And the military and the powers that be believed that was not going to work, of course. They were not going to affect that type of budgetary change. And because of that, they believed if that 500,000 people that Martin was going to bring would get more angry, and that their resistance would lead into open rebellion. And they didn't believe they had the forces to put down the rebellion on the streets of Washington. So he was never going to be ultimately allowed to bring that mass of Americans to Washington, D.C. And that was why they were going to have to get rid of him. And Memphis, of course, was the place that was selected. Sanitation workers' strike was used for the purpose of getting him into Memphis, and he was assassinated.
I'd like to remind listeners, this is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, and I'm in studio with Ken Burrows, who is co-hosting with me today. We're in conversation with Dr. William Pepper, and his most recent book is The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And here we are just past the 5th anniversary of the assassination of King. And William Pepper, you were just talking specifically about not only the issues of foreign policy and imperialism, and certainly the reason that a lot of people seem to generically go back to King in terms of race and racial injustice, but also his tying in of class and sort of the intersectionality of what he began to seriously represent through 1967 and then 1968. This is what you're saying is ultimately what's luring him to Memphis for the sanitation strike. And you keep saying they are luring him and this was a decision that was made to kill him. So I know you've talked about this certainly in your other book, Act of State, and in your new book, The Plot to Kill King, which contains many, many of the primary documents and historical documents. And I urge people to see your recent book, The Plot to Kill King, on Skyhorse Publishing. But can you talk a little bit more about who are they and what are these forces that are luring him there? Can you be a little bit more specific about that? And I certainly know your book does that.
Yeah, sure. In a broad, overall sense, when I refer to they, I'm talking about really basically the ruling forces of the corporate structure in America. And I'm speaking specifically about the finance houses and banks, major energy and oil corporations, all of whom have enormous power and try to exercise that in terms of public policy. Now, in terms of specifics as to who was involved, they're foot soldiers. When I identify these forces as ruling forces, their foot soldiers are agencies of government of the United States. And in the case of the assassination of Martin King, the primary agency that led the way was the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover. Hoover would send Clyde Tolson, his number two, into Memphis on a very regular basis. Tolson would come in, he would meet with the local Southern Mafia groups, mainly headed by the Adkins family, and they would begin to set up the details for the actual assassination. Tolson would also bring money in from Hoover, and that money would be put in paper bags with names on it of people who had jobs to do with respect to the assassination. So it was paying as well as giving instructions. They were organizing things on the ground with what we have come to call the Dixie Mafia. Now, when it came to James Earl Ray, he had been profiled earlier as a convict of Jefferson City Prison who would be likely to be a very good candidate for being a patsy in a case of this sort. So they organized James's escape. $25,000 was brought in by Tolson. It was carried to the warden of the prison by old man Adkins and his son, Ron. And it was Ron who became one of our witnesses who revealed to us everything that was going on. He rode to the prison with the money and his father. They paid off the warden. The warden organized James's escape. James was allowed to escape in April of 1967. And then he was kept on a string. They had a handler. They kept him on a string and moved him around the country. Initially, Martin King was to have been killed in Los Angeles. They had two army snipers and their spotters in Los Angeles. They were there for quite a period of time, and they kept James there for quite a period of time. Eventually, quickly, a decision was made to move them out and into the South. And that was when they designated Memphis as the scene of the assassination. And I wondered for a long time why they didn't go through with it in Los Angeles. And then I came to realize that there was another assassination that was being planned for Los Angeles following the California primary. And that, of course, took place a couple of months later, and Bob Kennedy was hit in Los Angeles. It would not do to have two major assassinations in the same city. So Martin's death was to be in Memphis. So that's the organizing up to the point of when he was actually shot. He was there to help the striking sanitation workers, and that was a part of his concern about economic injustice. And so he was there to help them and be victorious in terms of their strike. And then he was going to leave Memphis and begin the Poor People's March and encampment in Washington.
William Pepper, I know this is an aside, and I don't want to get too off the trail here, though I do think that this is entirely relevant when you brought up the Robert Kennedy assassination. Of course, you have been very active involved in the Sirhan Sirhan case. We talked about that the last time you were on the Project Censored show. But can you talk about the nexus here, if any, between RFK and MLK and their assassinations in this historic year of 1968?
Well, the nexus is they were really on the same page in terms of opposing the war in Vietnam. And Bob Kennedy had become aware of the economic plight of millions and millions of Americans and was determined to do something about that. He also, of course, was determined to reopen the investigation into the assassination of his brother. So that was another issue that was aside to the nexus between him and Martin King. Martin and Bobby were very close in terms of concern for the impoverished Americans and also in terms of the war. And they were building a joint following across the country that was bound to have an impact, and they really were not going to be allowed to do that. There even was some discussion that Bobby, when running for president of the United States, might have reached out, and there were some discussions about this, reached out and tried to take Martin King on as a running mate. So that they could even have broadened the relationship that much closer together. But that, of course, never got to fruition.
We're speaking with Dr. William Pepper, author most recently of The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. We'll continue our conversation with William Pepper after this musical break. Please stay with us.
William Pepper was a young man when he first met Dr. King. Read his war reporting on Viet children suffering. Martin asked young William Pepper to speak about the war, to come to his congregation, and they were friends forevermore. Then William went to law school to put his talents to the task, to fight for social justice, to answer questions we must ask. It was April 4, 1968, when Martin Luther King was murdered in the broad daylight. It was a devastating thing. It was a mighty rush to judgment, to blame it on James Earl Ray. There was agreement in the government to tell the media what to say. The media called it a crime of hate, a lone nut simple thing. Now we know it was an act of state, the execution of Dr. King. James Earl Ray was just a patsy, escaped prisoner for sure, with a top security identity for the whole 9 months before. Some rogues within the government shielded James as Eric Galt, gave him a car and a driver's license to secure him till the assault. To protect this petty criminal, to put the patsy into place, his handlers sent him to Memphis, where like a pawn he showed his face. Well, Martin marched for civil rights, and he stood against all war. He spoke for truth and justice and not violence for sure. When Martin stood with the workers in solidarity with the poor, that high-class oligarchy hated Martin, that's for sure. Earl Clark was one of the Memphis cops meeting at Lloyd Jowers Grill, across from the Lorraine Motel where Dr. King was killed. Two military sniper teams would have also fired if the police team from Memphis failed to do what was required. Next day, cops cleaned the crime scene, all the brush and proof away. They avoided all the witnesses that might have some truth to say. Too many unanswered questions still blowing in the wind. in a murder investigation so deliberately ruined. Too many disturbing answers still came out in the trial. Enough to prove conspiracy to a nation in denial. Six white, six black jurors unanimously agreed. The facts presented at the trial proved who really did the deed. Yes, it all came out in the trial that in 99 they won, when the government was convicted of the conspiracy they'd done. Press conference, no reporters came to report. So here's to William Pepper, the King family, brave and wise, for standing for the truth for us, for overcoming all the lies. William Pepper, keep on struggling, you know you're following the teachings and the vision and the dream of Dr. King. William Pepper wrote the book about trial and everything, an act of state, the execution of Martin Luther King, an act of state, the execution of Martin Luther King.
And that was the music of Vic Sado, the Truth Troubadour, who is here in Berkeley, California, where we broadcast the Project Censored show every week. Vic Sado, and that was his song called An Act of State, based on the same title of William Pepper's book about Martin Luther King's assassination. And, of course, this is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with special guest co-host Ken Burroughs, San Francisco State University. And we're talking with the author, William Pepper, about his most recent book on the King assassination, The Plot to Kill King. We continue our conversation with William Pepper now.
Bill, how is it that the King family came to work with you in a decade-long effort to really find the real killers of Dr. King, and what led up to the trial that happened in 1999?
The King family was familiar with my work going back before the first book, Orders to Kill. Orders to Kill was published in 1995. They knew that I was quietly gathering evidence and working on the case. I did not involve them, did not brief them, did not try to bring them in. Martin's nephew, Isaac Farris, read Orders to Kill, and he reached out to me and asked me to meet with the family. And I did that in, I guess, 1996. They were moved by what we learned at that point in time, which, remember, is many years ago. But what we learned at that point in time moved them. And so they wanted to pursue it, and they supported a trial for James Earl Ray, which, of course, was not going to happen. And they tried to get Bill Clinton to agree to conduct an investigation. He appointed Janet Reno, his attorney general, to be in charge of that investigation, and it really just, of course, turned out to be a complete whitewash. With this kind of frustration, I suggested that maybe what we should do is actually file a civil action against one of the people whom we knew and who had admitted being involved, Lloyd Jowers. They agreed. We filed a civil action in Memphis, and the trial went on for 30 days.
And this is the civil trial. This is the King v. Jowers in 1999.
Yes, that's right. King v. Jowers civil trial. Went on for 30 days. With some 70 witnesses, was not covered by the media. The media just stayed away. The court TV at first was, oh, yes, this is something we have to cover. Well, they were told not to think about it. So because of the degree of media control in matters of this sort, very few people know that trial took place. But it did, and it took a jury 59 minutes to find that James Earl Ray had knowing involvement in the killing, and agents of the government of the United States, state of Tennessee, city of Memphis did. And so that was the result of the civil trial. And the King family believed when that happened that we had closure, and they had closure. And I was very pleased about that. But of course, between 1999 and 2016, when the final book, The Plot to Kill King, was released, we acquired an enormous amount of additional evidence and information about the assassination, how it took place, how King was actually killed, which is very important. And that, as far as I'm concerned now, is closure. Coretta has died, but three of the children are alive. Yolanda also died, but three of the children are alive.
Bill, can you speak to more how a King actually died versus the way we've been told he died in the media?
He was shot from the bushes in the back of the rooming house by a Memphis Police Department sharpshooter. He was hit in the face and went down and lost consciousness. He was, however, alive. He was taken to St. Joseph's Hospital. He was in the emergency room. They were working on him in the emergency room. The chief of neurosurgery, the head neurosurgeon, a doctor named Breen Bland, B-L-A-N-D, who was also the family doctor for the Dixie Mafia family, the Adkins family, came in with two men in suits and told the people, stop working on that nigger, get out and just let him die.
And that's a quote that you got during deposition?
That's an actual quote, yeah.
And that's in the book. That's actually in one of the appendices in The Plot to Kill King. You have the transcript of that.
Yeah. What I have insisted on doing is I insisted on putting in the complete text of all of the relevant transcripts, dumb depositions, all of them, so that I can't be accused of taking things out of context or making them up. The actual depositions, the statements sworn under oath are there. So Bland said to this emergency room group that were working on King to get out of there. Stop working. That was the quote. Stop working on that nigger. Just let him die and get out. And he threw them all out of the room. The last one to leave the room was a surgical nurse. Her name was Shelby. And as she was leaving, she heard them gathering spit up in their mouths like this. And that caught her attention, so she turned around, looked over her shoulder, and then she saw them spit on the body of Dr. King, saw Dr. Bland pull out the catheter and take a pillow and put the pillow over his face and suffocate him. Now, he might have died anyway from his wounds. It was a severe wound. But nevertheless, he was still alive. And they were not going to take any chances that he might survive.
And William Pepper, now, just to be clear, this was information presented in the trial to the jury.
No.
Right.
No,
okay. No. So that's what I'm trying to get at here. So
yes,
this is what I'm getting at, because like you mentioned earlier, I just wanted to clarify that sure. was not the case, because A, most people are still not aware of this 1999 trial.
I know.
Number one. And the media did a splendid job of ignoring it and covering it up.
And why is that the case, Bill? Why do you think the media, including progressive media, has just failed to cover this? Can you speak to that issue?
Well, of course, the corporate media refuses, because the corporate media is controlled basically by the ruling moneyed forces of the society, who want to keep the people calm. We don't want them to be anxious. We don't want them to lose confidence in their government. Don't want them in any way to question the credibility of the agencies of government who are paid so much money in their budgets every year. So that's true with respect to the corporate media. They've really pretty much now buttoned down control of the corporate media on cases of this sort. When it comes to progressive media, they also have had ways of compromising progressive media. And so it's a great disappointment that a lot of our progressive media people simply will not deal with this, will not deal with this kind of case or this kind of issue. Now, why is that? Well, progressive media entities often are recipients of grants and awards from entities like the Ford Foundation, and that's CIA money for the most part. So they're not going to risk losing that. They don't want to cover this. And they don't cover it. Let's face it. It's only chaps like you.
Certainly at Project Censored, we have a deep interest in this. My co-host and associate, Dr. Peter Phillips, actually teaches a course that uses your Act of State book in it, in a sociology of conspiracy class that looks at historical conspiracy fact and looks how it challenges dominant narratives. So you're certainly on the right program as far as that issue goes. But William Pepper, given that this didn't come out in the trial, could you explain to the listeners how you got this information and how you got this deposition and why you included it in the book?
After the trial, just as after an HBO Thames television mock trial back in 92, people started to become more aware of what was going on, and some people who had vital information were approaching the grave and wanted to share it. So people came forward. One of the people who came forward was the son of the surgical nurse. His name was Jonathan Shelby. And Jonathan went into deposition with us and laid out everything the mother told them the next morning when she came home. She gathered them in the parlor and she said, "I still don't understand why they had to kill him." And then she explained what she saw and what she heard in the emergency room. So Jonathan talked about that in detail. Then the son of the Dixie Mafia leader, Adkins, who had sat in on so many meetings with his father and who knew Tolson very well and talked about Tolson's coming in continually, he came forward and agreed to go under oath. And over many hours, I think upwards of 11 hours, I deposed Ron Tyler Adkins and gave him all the opportunity that he needed to tell everything that he knew. So that we started to get this information. We started to get it well after 1999. You know, we got it into 2010, 11, 12, 13.
And so this is the reason for this other book, then. This is after Act of State, because you uncovered some of this. You had revealed some of these things in the Act of State book, but then you discovered so much more since.
Yes, that's right. This was the final book, and for me, it's the end of the story. There is really nothing more that I can do or say or expect to learn. You know, I've been on this for about 40 years, and that's what it's taken to slowly get to the bottom of what really happened to Dr. King.
And in your mind, what's the difference between the 99 jury verdict and your conclusions in the plot to kill King?
They're the same. I mean, in the sense that the jury found that agents of the government, three governments, federal, state, and local, were responsible for the killing of Martin King. And as we worked on this, we got more definitive information, more specific information, so we were able to name the people. We were able to name the people who were involved in the actual killing.
Can you name them here?
Sure. I had lunch with the shooter. His name is Frank Strauser. He's still alive. He was the one who pulled the trigger that hit Martin and knocked him down. So Strauser was the shooter. His spotter was another Memphis police officer called Earl Clark. Frank Holloman, who was the head of police and fire in Memphis and who had worked for a number of years in Hoover's office in Washington. Basically, it's emerged that he was the real on-the-ground coordinator after Russell Adkins died. It was Holloman who actually organized things on the ground. Frank Liberto, a mafioso, who worked with the Memphis Police Department, organized the shooting. I couldn't name Strauser for a number of years because the man who gave me his information was a janitor at the police firing range in Memphis, and he observed Strauser preparing the entire day, firing a specially delivered rifle, and then leaving at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Gave us a lot of detailed information, but I couldn't reveal it because I was afraid they would kill him. So I had to hold on to that segment of information for a number of years. Lenny Curtis was his name, brave man. And we just waited. Finally, Lenny died, and we were able to use his deposition. We had it filmed in a transcribed deposition. So that was very important in terms of nailing the shooter, although the shooter didn't kill him. And the killing was by this Dr. Bland. And Ron Tyler, the Adkins boy, was present when Bland said to his father, if he's not killed with the shot, be sure he gets to my hospital so we can make sure that he doesn't leave there alive. That's how we built up this information in later years.
Thank you. It's very clear, Bill. And thank you for your good work all these years, just to acknowledge that. We thought of closing our interview. We're getting close to this now. Just a thought about Dr. King being a moral voice of our time. And if he were alive today, what advice do you think he would give us?
I think he would say, keep your powder dry and your values steadfast and your heart always going in the right direction. I think he would say, patience is required. This system is headed toward an enormous change, and the light will soon become brighter and brighter. But you must, as a part of your resistance, you must stay firm in terms of values and also in terms of determination. I believe that's what he would say.
William Pepper, you write in the preface of your book, you say that your work, which began 9 years after the assassination, continued to the present, has resulted in two books, 1995, 2003, and then, of course, this one, The Plot to Kill King, in 2016. So this is what you call your culminating work, the final work on this topic for you. The book pulls all of the previous work together, leading up to a revelation of the most devastatingly depressive final act in the life of this much-loved man. You go on to say, due to the absence of any courage by the mainstream corporate media, the disinformers have largely been successful in keeping the truth buried. Even today, they persist. And yet, you have the courage to lay all of this out in The Plot to Kill King for all to see.
Well, we try to do the best we can, but whatever I can do in terms of manifestation of courage is just a mere shadow of Martin King's presence and life work and the debt that I feel we all owe to him.
Dr. William Pepper, thank you so much for coming back on the Project Censored Show. Your latest book, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., out on Skyhorse Publishing. Thank you so much, Bill Pepper, for all of your work and for coming on the program today.
You're welcome, guys. Thanks so much for your continued interest.
After this brief musical break, we'll return to the Project Censored Show, where I'll be talking to our guest co-host Ken Burrows, who has for many years run a program at San Francisco State University, Gandhi King, Seasons of Nonviolence. So please stay with us.
What is it about Birmingham? What is it about Buffalo? The hate-filled, water-filled bunkers in your beautiful red earth. They want to build them in our shiny white snow. And now I've drawn close the curtain. This little booth where the truth has no place to stand. And I am feeling, oh, so powerless in this stupid booth with this useless little lever in my hand. And outside, my city is bracing for the next killing thing, standing by the bridge and praying for the next Dr. Martin Luther.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. Today, I'm Mickey Huff with Ken Burrows. Earlier in the program, we were in conversation with the best-selling author, William Pepper, about his most recent book, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And Ken Burrows, you have certainly known William Pepper for some time. You've interviewed him yourself, and you run an entire speaker series every winter into spring at San Francisco State University on Gandhi to King, Seasons of Nonviolence. And you've been on the Project Censored show before to talk about that. But let's remind listeners, what exactly is this that you do at San Francisco State University? Because it is something that's also open to the public, many of the events. And also, you know, comment on how you got there. What drew you to doing this? Because it's an amazing series of events you put on every year.
Well, the Gandhi King season for nonviolence actually occurs between the assassination dates of Gandhi, which was January 30th, and King's assassination, which we just passed, April 4th. That's a 64-day period, 9 weeks. This originated actually because of a coalition of churches who wondered how we can take the principles of nonviolence, which we'll talk about in just a moment, that King and Gandhi were exemplars of, and a new type of activism that Gandhi and King and Cesar Chavez and others that followed in their footsteps. How do we talk about their kind of activism versus just simply the blaming and shaming that often goes on with conventional activism that's really all about resistance, but really doesn't necessarily talk about the greater good and the integrative healing aspects that need to go on within the culture as well? So their lives as examples of loving and socially just leaders. Their family stepped in, and with these interfaith churches, it was claimed this season is claimed every year between their memorial dates as a time of practicing how to live a life that's more loving, or should say lives that are more loving, more meaningful, and less violent. And so we've had our own way of practicing this, as our other faith and academic communities throughout the country. So there'll be institutions, whether they be at a university or a church or a nonprofit, that are also hosting their own versions of using this educational era, these 9 weeks, to begin to think about what our culture is about currently and the violence within our culture, and to begin to have very clear alternatives to that violence, and to look at that the way we host it anyway, within three segments. The first 3 weeks of this series is the 3 weeks we focus on our inner life. What can I do about my own thoughts, my own emotional reactivity, my own sense of being violent and less loving in my life? That's my practice, those first 3 weeks. And everyone is invited into this. The second 3 weeks are about my relationships with others, my significant relationships with the people I care the most about. How do I really deepen those relationships and learn the difficult challenges that come in relationship, about how to be more connected and more relational with each other in ways that are constructive? In the last 3 weeks, we focus on our relationships with the world. How do I acknowledge my life as political and societal, and how do I respect my efforts toward the common good? So that's a general frame.
You're combining certainly the teachings of nonviolence, and certainly people like Gandhi and King certainly are among some of the folks that definitely come to mind in the 20th century. I wanted to also give an opportunity here for you to talk a little bit more specifically up to date, because you run this speaker series and you invite many different people to come in. I know I've actually been in talking about Project Censored during some of the same time period that you've done this. But who are the current voices for nonviolence that you are plugged into that you think are really carrying this mission?
That's a great question. Well, again, each of these dimensions, the self, others, and world, or earth, if you will, we acknowledge there will be leaders within each of these dimensions of our lives. So those that have psychological practices that support this, and those that have social practices, and of course those that are more political in orientation. So when I think of the psychological work, I think right away of Gandhi, who started this thing, recognizing we need a way to be in the world that is not just likely to cause harm to ourselves and to a system, but just to understand what nonviolence is, that very kind of activism that has psychological roots within it has to do with respecting everyone, including the opponent, and that your activism is really something that is in a way to convert your opponent to understand a bigger picture of what's going on, so that nonviolence is not just about not being violent. It's about principled nonviolence. It's about revealing injustice wherever it is by refusing to go along with it. So the emotional and psychological costs that come with standing up to injustice, you have to prepare for this. You have to do the psychological work to be able to engage in the more activistic revelations that come with being willing to take on the upset of the opponent who might not want to be outed by your behavior. So that whole psychological work is not just for you. It leads into the second and third steps of the season as well. When I think of the second part of the season, I think of nonviolent communication, of really learning how to communicate in ways that are more need-based and less reactive. And when we are reactive, we become reactive, we use those moments with those we care about as teaching opportunities to really learn how to relate to each other more deeply. So really valuing conflict, Gandhi said it very simply, conflict reveals. Conflict always teaches if you're willing. So entering there, there's sociocracy practices are really changing the nature of groups right now. How do we establish not just consensus circles, but collaborative groups within circles that help us become more efficient and not just get lost in this constant litany and discussion period of consensus? And so there's this evolution going on within the small groups. And then finally, the last segment, which is more about the politics. That's where we might even spend a little bit more time if you want to.
Let's do that. And again, feel free to name some of the people that you think are current manifestations of this. It's something that Daniel Ellsberg wrote an essay for us a few years ago in Censored 2014. And he was specifically speaking about whistleblowers and Chelsea Manning and others. But he used the phrase civil courage. Now you're kind of segueing into politics here. And that's really kind of what we're looking at with whether it's a Gandhi or a King or a Manning or a Snowden or a Sybil Edmonds or Colleen Rowley at around 9/11. And whistleblowers oft get a bad rap. Often the criticism is that, well, they want to be the center of attention. And the irony of that is that all the whistleblowers I just named, they specifically said the opposite. In fact, they kind of just were thrown into the maelstrom, and it's as if they were trying to catch up to themselves. They were already there trying to, quote, do the right thing, and they had to kind of catch up to themselves to realize, what did I get myself into here? Because there are great and dire consequences for speaking such truths and revealing such information, particularly in a place like the United States, where we have the illusions of democracy and transparency, right?
So Gandhi called satyagraha the willingness to be the truth and to trust truth, that by revealing truth, the larger truth of asaya and injustice, you have to expect there will be repercussions of the established order. They will resist that revelation, and they will resist you in your expression of it. And yet, that is what a whistleblower does. That is what any of us would do if that principle is to be honored, is that you express it.
And that's what William Pepper has been doing for 40 years.
His whole life and three books expressing this, trying to get people to be aware of this. And yet still most of us aren't. So to be a nonviolent activist is to really be in the game in a way that incurs the insight, the perspective. And that's why media is so important. If the media isn't there observing this, then often your activism cannot be covered and therefore will be buried. And the injustice of the moment becomes an instruction point for the injustice within the system itself as it tries to protect itself against this revelation about truth. That becomes the teaching and the practice of an activist that really sees this. And these are the social justice movements around the world that are lasting. They become sustainable because there isn't one more revolution to protect. It's an evolution of thinking that actually begins to ripple out, and with that, society is informed and becomes protective of this larger understanding. So we spent time at San Francisco State certainly looking at the economy, that the violence of much of our life is structural violence due to the nature of a debt-created currency system, of a banking system and corporate system where profit is channeled to a few and the masses are left with much less. So the whole metaphor of the top 1% or less than 1% actually really being the owners is what we've stepped into, and that we're really not a democracy anymore, as a number of studies have indicated.
Or weren't in the first place.
Yes. But to look at this economic force that is driving all of our lives is a primary piece. So the violence within capitalism and how do we reform and heal that is part of what we do. We always focus on that.
Indeed. And, you know, since you just mentioned media a little bit and we can riff on this, I couldn't help but think, of course, during our conversation with William Pepper of one of my favorite Michael Parenti quotes back in the 90s when Michael had written one of his many, many books, a book called History as Mystery. And in a lot of ways, what we see here with William Pepper is he's kind of the historian, lawyer, detective, also storyteller in a lot of ways, right? And it's very fascinating to me that one of Parenti's quotes that I always use in classes is that those engaged in the manufacturing of history often introduce distortions at the point of origin well before the history is written or even played out. And this initial process of control is not usually left to chance, but is regularly pursued by interested parties who are situated to manipulate the record. Mm-hmm. And often then journalism functions as the first draft or rough draft of history. And right out of the gate, you get these spun, partial, erroneous, or even completely disinformative narratives. Mm-hmm. And it's, I guess, hard-pressed to find a better example in that case of what Pepper talks about with the King assassination. Yes. And then, of course, he also talked about it with Sirhan Sirhan and the Kennedy assassination. So the role that journalism plays is so significant in getting the information to people, right? And it's not just a sort of journalism that looks at all of the problems or highlights all of these troublesome or negative things, but it's a different kind of journalism. And I know this is something that you focus on quite a bit, not just solutions journalism, but there's also generative journalism. And there are other ways of approaching the storytelling that doesn't just deconstruct the problem. Say a few words about that.
Well, propaganda-driven narratives, first of all, are really a poor issue for all of us. The challenge being that we don't know we're swimming in them and that we're relying on them, and they become literally what we believe. So that's, I think, the main reason we have this season for nonviolence, is to begin to clarify a larger narrative, and narratives that are more meaningful, again, more loving, more social, and more about how do we construct and create and support the common good. So that said, constructive media, what is that about? And what does a mindful media scholarship and mindful media movement look like? And I would suggest that, yes, solution-based media is important because we all like innovation. We like thinking outside the box and changing the game with something that's more innovative and creative. And yet mindful media is also about really taking it deeper, about really noticing what's truly going on here that you might not have seen before, and noticing something new you haven't been paying attention to, and deepening your narrative and your understanding of this ongoing propaganda swimming pool we're in, and really begin to clarify what this larger story might look like and your place in that.
We're speaking with Ken Burrows. He's a professor at San Francisco State University and actually runs the Holistic Health Center there. Ken Burrows is also on the board of directors at Media Freedom Foundation, has been a longtime contributor to Project Censored, and has certainly been on the Project Censored show many times. And I wanted to thank Ken Burrows and Byron Belitzos for helping set up the program today with William Pepper. And it's important not only that we thank people that are speaking fearlessly, right, in these fateful times. And it's, of course, important to acknowledge places like Skyhorse Publishing for putting out this 800-page book from Pepper, David Talbot's Hot Books, our publishers at Seven Stories Press that publish our book every year, and these other media outlets. And we heard Bill Pepper saying that there are many, many places where we have these platforms where the fish are aware they're swimming in the pool of propaganda and they're trying to jump out of that and maybe make a new pool, right? And so we certainly want to celebrate those kinds and those types of media. But just wanted to maybe get some of your final remarks based on your experience with what you do with your students and the Seasons of Nonviolence. And having been in conversation just earlier in the program with William Pepper, how would you summarize your ideas about the conversation we had with Pepper? And what would you hope that listeners should take away from that? Not telling them what they need to take away from it, mm-hmm. but what are some things that you think are important that you'd like people to consider?
That's a very reflective question, and one I would like to set with, but given our limits on time, I'll just speak to that really goodness, truth, and beauty is not something that's foregrounded very much in our media. We have such a reactive culture that we don't often hold space for really noticing the greater good that's really what humanity is about. And this season for nonviolence, just interviewing Bill Pepper, to me, just the goodness of this person that can hold this together for 40 years doing this terrifically challenging work, despite really not getting the wide audience that he deserves, that he can continue to do this work at the depth of his own heart and mind. And the greatness that comes to all of us, I think, when we step into this deeper reservoir of truth and goodness within ourselves and call that out and find each other, that's, I think, the missing piece for many of us, that we're told we need to do this alone, when in fact it's in partnership and in sharing. It has a lot to do with understanding this threefold revolution that King talked about, the personal, the social, and the political, that they all have to be integrated in a way that just give our life more sense and more, if you will, goodness, truth, and beauty as we do it.
Indeed, Ken Burroughs. And I'd like to close our conversation on the positive note of reminding us of the power of the First Amendment that we do have in the United States that does, at least on paper, put forth the serious and significant principles of free speech, expression, right? And certainly the protection of the free press. And of course, at Project Censored, that's something that we've been touting for 40 years. That reminds me, on a closing note, of a fantastic quote from the founder of Project Censored, Carl Jensen, who 20-some years ago wrote this, and I think it's just as true now, maybe more now than ever, about the significance of journalism and storytelling and how it can not just report about where we are, but shine the light and help us find the better places to be, forge the path. And Carl Jensen wrote, quote, "Since we'll all benefit from a more responsible media, we all really should help bring it about. And to do this, the corporate media owners should start to earn their unique First Amendment privileges. Editors should rethink their news judgment. Journalists should persevere in going after the hard stories. Journalism professors should emphasize ethics and critical analysis and turn out more muckrakers and fewer buckrakers. The judicial system should defend freedom of the press provision of the First Amendment with far more vigor, and the public should show the media it's more concerned with the high crimes and misdemeanors of its political and corporate leaders than it is with the crimes and gossip of celebrities. The effort will be well worth it." And I could not agree more. And after today's conversation with William Pepper and with you, Ken Burroughs, I think the effort is certainly well worth it. And it's an honor to be here with you. It was an honor to have on Bill Pepper. And certainly we will forge ahead at Project Censored because we do think that the effort is well worth it. So, Ken, thanks so much for being here today, helping co-host and also sharing your thoughts about what you do.
My pleasure. And just to acknowledge the end of all of our struggles together and our work toward a greater future is what Martin Luther King called the beloved community, that we actually can show up and be in a celebration and connection with and for each other. And I hope that's where we're all going.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, 'cause they own my special interest.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The West Virginia Wildcat Strike of 2018. Olivia Morris, a West Virginia teacher and grassroots strike leader, talks about the historic 9-day Wildcat Strike. It lasted from February 22nd to March 7, 2018. She's in conversation with Stacey Davis Gates, political director for the Chicago Teachers Union. This is a personal, very candid conversation about a strike in an anti-union right-to-work state, about alliances between teachers and public workers, a broken-down healthcare system, how low or no taxes for coal and gas extraction diminish the money needed for education, and more. The Chicago Teachers Union described the event this way: the Wildcat Strike by West Virginia teachers, among the lowest paid teachers in the nation, has ignited public support across the state and the nation, with teachers in states from Oklahoma to Kentucky looking at strategies to bring the West Virginia model of strike resistance and rank-and-file democracy to their states. In West Virginia, teachers rejected efforts by political leaders and top union officials to settle without an ironclad guarantee of improved wages. Not just for them, but for all state public employees. Teachers struck for those guarantees, even though West Virginia is a right-to-work state, which bans strikes by public workers. The Wildcat strike derailed plans by state legislators to jack up health insurance premiums in the Public Employee Insurance Agency, PEIA, and to jam through a charter school bill being promoted by corporations. Teachers and their supporters are demanding West Virginia legislators reverse corporate tax cuts, raise gas severance tax, and hold harmless any public programs to fund their new one raises. That's how the Chicago Teachers Union sees the results of the West Virginia Wildcat strike. Here now, strike leader Olivia Morris. Her small group of teachers and activists had decided to begin by informing their colleagues in school cafeteria meetings of the impending rise in healthcare cost that would more than absorb any gains in salaries for teachers and public workers. Olivia Morris remembers how terrified she was standing before her own colleagues. She had no notion then that the group of 25 she was addressing would become part of 33,000 in a matter of a few weeks. Olivia Morris.
Are they going to look at me like I am some bad person who's trying to preach to them about politics? Mm-hmm. Are they going to agree with me or understand? And so I stood up and I was shaking. I mean, I am an actor. I will talk in front of hundreds and hundreds of people, mm-hmm. but I was shaking in front of these 25 people. But as I stood there talking about insurance and talking about the taxes that have been cut and the jobs that have decreased and how the 1% raise that the governor had promised us in his state of state address, the insurance mm-hmm. was going to eat the 1% raise that we were getting. As I was telling them these things, I saw the people who I was most terrified of mm-hmm. shaking their heads. That helped me kind of move forward, and it helped open up the conversations that they were having in the teachers' lounge at lunch breaks.
Because they were already aware that they were going to be losing.
They weren't until I talked to them.
So no one had informed them?
No. No one.
So talk to me about how you go from being up in front of your staff, 25 people talking about this, to a 20,000 person Facebook group.
We were really struggling, my friends and I, in this small cluster of group, because we only had maybe 1,000 members in the group.
Okay.
And we were discussing, why aren't more people upset about this? Why aren't more people talking about this? Do they not know? Do they not care? Do they not know how? Are they feeling like they're being preached at?
Right.
What's going on? How can we get them involved? And someone said, when are we going to go on strike? And I'm not kidding you, 24 hours later, we were up to 16,000 members.
Interesting.
And then, you know, a week later, we were at 20,000.
The S word is what catalyzed
it did.
The response from the people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So then how do you take 20,000 people on the in a Facebook chat and then begin to organize across the state? Because when I saw all of you in red in the state capitol, mm-hmm. I was like, somebody has really everyone off. Because, like, we ain't all going to agree on one thing in here, right? So how do you fill a state capitol with, in a state with regional differences, mm-hmm. to your point, partisan differences, religious issues mm-hmm. with the word strike? Like, how do you do that? So who's your boogeyman in West Virginia? Like, who was the guy hanging in effigy? Because it's a guy.
At first, it was the PEIA board. Okay. It was a Public Employees Insurance Agency. At first, it was them.
Okay. How
many people yeah. on the board? Six.
Are they elected or appointed?
They are appointed by the governor, and it used to be that they had one teacher who was representative, uh-huh. and one service personnel representative. And then last year, 2 years ago, I'm sorry.
After Right to Work.
It was cut.
Yep.
They were cut.
Okay.
So then it was just these people appointed
okay.
who were on the PEIA board. That quickly turned to, it's not the PEIA insurance board, it's the government.
Okay.
It is the legislature, because they haven't given the board any money to work with. Mm-hmm. Health insurance costs are rising.
So you've identified we don't have enough revenue.
Yes.
Okay. Keep talking.
Yeah. So insurance costs are rising. We found out that it would be $50 million or $60 million in addition to what we were already making for this year. And then with 6% inflation every year after that.
She's a math teacher.
that they would have to give us to be able to keep the benefits that we have.
Okay.
So the way that PEIA, because the legislature said, well, this is the money that we're giving you, we are, and the term is fixed PEIA or fully fund PEIA, mm-hmm. the Republicans, and I hate it that it's down the line, but it was strictly straight down the line, Democrats voting and Republicans voting, but they were saying, we have fully funded PEIA. We've given them the money. They just need to figure out what to do with it. It's mm-hmm. them. So it was a lot of, you know, back and forth blaming one another. But people were smarter than that. People saw through that. Mm-hmm. So then once we found that out as a core group, we really pushed that to the members at large before the politicians started blaming it on the PEIA board. Everybody knew that it was the revenue issue. And so I know that some people, members, rank and file members, went to the union leaders, but they didn't believe that teachers were ready. They didn't believe that a strike was going to happen.
So what made them believe?
Oh, they had to. It was happening mm-hmm. in front of their eyes. So they had to say, okay.
So then, because I can imagine this tension, right? So you laid out that they're doing their annual lobby day. They're having these conversations mm-hmm. and things are still moving at snail's pace. They're in this circle from the board to the legislature to the board, you know, hamster on a wheel, basically.
Yeah.
And then Facebook.
Facebook, yeah.
Right? Well, it's not Facebook, but Facebook.
That was the platform at which it
right.
happened, yeah.
And then do you guys just start showing up in Charleston? Like, how does anyone get a clue
okay.
that this exists, right? Do you send out a press release? Is it a hustle, a mass tweet? What's going on here?
So I like to describe West Virginia as each section of the state, because there aren't very many, have their own characters, that have their okay. own, they're a child of the family. Mm-hmm. And Southern West Virginia is that wild, rebellious child, going to be damned if anybody stops them from doing what they want to do.
Okay.
So their role, because they have, out of anybody in the state, they have been beaten, battered, abused, and the only word to describe it, we have tried to find another word, but they have been raped.
Wow.
Of everything.
Now that's pretty provocative. Can you explain, like, what goes into, like, making a decision to use that particular word to describe the context of their lives there?
So, coal.
Okay.
Is the ground that we live on and that they live on. And it's the only thing, when West Virginia was settled, it was basically settled and they saw, oh, coal, let's extract it. Let's do something with it. Mm-hmm. They decided, okay, let's start extracting this, which it was working for them fine
for sure.
because it was the local people pulling it out to power their homes and power their businesses. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, they saw here's an ability to make money. A larger company came in and it turned into, and I I don't know the history well enough, but I know that out-of-state corporations, they gave the workers, eventually, after the union wars, mm-hmm. they gave them money mm-hmm. for their land and money for the coal. But at first, they didn't. And they were just, they took everything and didn't put it back into.
So robbed the land of his resources.
Yeah. And they're about to do the same thing with gas. Yes, they're giving money to the landowners. Yes, they're giving money to the workers, which they should have done. They should have given money to the landowners and to the workers who worked freaking hard for their companies.
But they pay no taxes.
They pay no taxes okay. to the state of West Virginia. And so now they have left, and we don't have anything to keep our economy alive. Mm-hmm. The rest of the state has not benefited from that money, and not only the rest of the state, but the areas of southern West Virginia are hit hard by the opioid crisis.
So how did they drag the rest of you guys with them?
I don't think they dragged us with them.
Okay.
I think that they inspired us and made us feel comfortable.
Okay.
It was like, oh man, we're itching to do this. We want to do okay. this. We want to do this, but we have so much fear and we have a lot of apprehension, and how are we going to do it? And are we going to have all of the support? The same questions you all are asking. How are we going to get the people from the Eastern Panhandle who have talked about seceding from us and, you know, becoming part of Virginia because
right.
they have better working conditions
right.
and higher taxes and better, higher property taxes, so that way
right.
they can get better public education systems
right.
and who commute to Washington, D.C. How are we going to get them a part of this fight? And Southern West Virginia said, we don't care if y'all join us. We're going to do it anyway because it's what we want and it's what we deserve.
Right.
And so it was an inspiration to us
okay.
to say, all right, I guess we can do it.
Okay.
And I guess it doesn't matter if we have everybody with
us.
So
is it a
or
bus or is it a carpool? Is it a march? How do you get there? I'm relating it back to our struggle here. I remember like a series of small things that we did, rallies, demonstrations, and then boom, right?
Yeah.
Did it take all of that?
Okay, so the Southern counties called it Fed Up Friday.
Okay.
And they demanded the union leaders in the counties to take a vote on whether or not to go. Of course, they had almost unanimous vote to go out.
Okay.
But they, I guess, wanted to do it officially, and they, you know, are paying union dues, so they mm-hmm. want the unions to do the work. And then they all went in buses
okay.
to the Capitol. Hundreds of people. I was lucky enough to be able to go, and I just was crying the whole time, like, oh my gosh, these people are so amazing, and they're chanting, and they all had these red shirts that every single one of them were the exact same. They had their counties on the back.
Okay.
That's what they did. And then everybody else said, all right, we're ready to go Monday. Let's all go Monday. And the union said, no, we can't go Monday. You don't understand what a strike entails. You don't understand what's going to happen. So they said, you need public support. We need public support. We need to say that we have done absolutely everything
mm-hmm.
before we go on strike, because that's our last card. That's the last card we have. We can't.
And what did you guys say?
We said, okay, fine, we'll do what you want. But that pent up so much energy, and there was so much anger for those 3 days.
Let's stay there for a moment.
Uh-huh.
So demands are happening we're flying the plane as we're building the plane.
Mm-hmm.
We're risking everything,
right.
but not very clear
yeah.
on what we're about to get.
Yeah.
You have a leadership that isn't necessarily plugged into everyone that's inside of the Capitol.
Yeah, right.
There are competing negotiating stances
mm-hmm.
and desires from this group and this group, this region and that region. They go into a room, they come out and say, we won. And you said, no, we didn't. And you said, and they said, let's go back to work. And you said, no, we're not. Okay, so then what happens? Like, at that moment when you tell them no, what happens?
oh, man. I don't want to say all, But because there were some people who were adamant about what they were going to do. They weren't going to back down. No, mm-hmm. we're not going to leave. But there were also people who had that question. Well, geez, there's so much more to this than us just going and yelling. Then all that night throughout the Facebook group, people were asking. And then Saturday, gosh, I don't know. It seems like a whole year went by in those 9 days. But Saturday was a small crowd. That was the day that everything happened, was okay. That Saturday.
So tell us more.
That was the day when they finally had the Senate Finance Committee, right, finally decided to talk.
Because up until this time, like, we're watching it from afar, and they're telling us that, you know, the money isn't there. We can offer you this much.
Right.
You guys say no. And then, you know, everyone goes back into a room.
Yeah. So there were so many different stances or changes about how much money they were going to give us.
Okay.
At first, it was 1%. Then it was 1% over 5 years. Then it was 2%, 1%, 1%, 1%. Then it was 2%, 1%, 1%. They were hoping to get that by without anybody noticing somehow.
No math teachers.
No. And then Governor Justice, who had been completely MIA the whole time, decided to go on town hall tours. And a young boy, Gideon, sixth grade, stood up and asked him the question, why are you putting gas companies above us? Why are you fighting so hard against giving teachers and public employees what they need? And then he gave them this spiel about how, well, if you charge too many taxes, then the businesses won't come here, and then we won't be able to have a good economy.
Mm-hmm.
And the boy said, well, why aren't you investing in the kids? Because we can grow up. And we can make a good economy, too, if we're educated.
Mm-hmm.
And
there were cameras.
And there were cameras. And he went home. Governor Justice went home. And the next day, he went to the negotiating table with the union leaders.
Okay.
And I think that they were amazed at what the governor did. Because he came in and he said, I'll give you everything.
So after
That's
being
on your
absent,
checklist.
He says hi. And they swoon.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And they were just kind of like, okay, well, we got it. Yeah, sure. This is a great step in the right direction, guys. Let's go back to school on Thursday. We are on the task force. It will be good. It's a great step in the right direction. And people were like, what? Are you kidding me? No, we're not going back. How dare you do that and speak for us? The bill was eventually amended because they had passed the 2-1-1. And so the bill was amended and sent to the House. The House, all but one person voted yes to the bill. So Republican, Democrat, everyone voted yes to the 5%.
What day is this again?
Day 5.
Day 5. Now, are parents calling them? Are parents emailing them?
That was one of the steps, was we have done everything that we can. Not yet, though. Not
okay.
yet. So
okay.
It had gone to the House. The House had said yes, and it was being sent to the Senate. The Senate tabled it. They would not see to it because they did not believe the governor was telling the truth. Not that he was lying, but that he was like our president and just spewing things out because he wanted it to happen.
Okay.
So they said, the revenue's not there. We don't have the money. What money is he talking about? He said that we only had 1%. You all should be happy with 1%. Last year, the union said they'd be happy with a 2% raise when the money wasn't there. Why are you asking for more? Why aren't you happy? And they just delayed and delayed and delayed and tabled the bill and wanted to talk about it.
At the same time, the session is almost over too, right?
Yes.
Right?
We had 10 days left, I think, or something.
So you're racing against the end of session.
Mm-hmm.
Kids have been out of school for a number of days. And the tactic is, or the strategy is, to stall.
Yeah, and to get the public against the teachers. We are going to anger the public because the teachers are being selfish and not going back to school, so they were just delaying, until they had their finance people look over and find out if the money was there. Well, it turns out, which we all knew, and this proves us right in the end in not going back, because if imagine had we actually gone back on Thursday, we would not have gotten any of this. But they said that they were waiting on a fiscal note from the governor's office. Well, the fiscal note was there from the House, from the governor and the House the whole time. They also said that they were trying to find out, because they wanted it to go to the Senate Finance Committee. The Finance Committee had to approve it, and then it had to go to the Senate, and then they had to approve it. The Finance Committee said, well, we can't talk about this. They put it 15th on their agenda. Out of 15 items, they put it very last. And they kept saying, well, it's just not right for us to delay, you know, put everything on hold for these educators. It's just not right for us to stop the way that politics work. And it's like, come on, you have thousands of people outside. You don't see the urgency in this. You have kids waiting. So turns out it all unfolded because the Senate voted down the bill. They said no, because at that point they had said no. Oh, they amended the bill to say 4% for teachers. It went back to the House. The House voted no against that 4% bill. So then they had to create a special, smaller
conference committee.
Mm-hmm. And then that conference committee stalled. And they apparently, it came out in this, they hadn't asked for the information that they were trying to find from the state superintendent's office about the amount of money that people made, that they hadn't even asked for it, that they said they were waiting on, but they hadn't even asked for it. And once they did ask for it, they got it within 30 minutes of asking for it. And they said that they were waiting the whole time to find out this information.
So you're dealing with incompetence. You're dealing with
just flat out lies. Flat out lies.
Okay, just flat out lies.
Yep.
So how do you keep this then? How do you sustain what was so, like, polarizing in your state? How do you sustain that? Because now it's not about health insurance anymore. You have your health insurance. What is it about next? How do you maintain this coalition of the willing?
That is a discussion that we're having right now. And we are actually looking towards you all as the example of what to do next. And I got on the Facebook page today. I've kind of been trying to stay away from it just to be able to relax a little bit, because I know that there's more to do. And so I need to kind of get out of that realm and kind of refocus and retrain my brain to think outside of the box or creatively. And I looked at it today, and apparently there's been a lot of division already, even within the last 3 days since we came back.
Where are the roots of?
I think it's going to the things that we ignored before. Before, we had education as something to bring us together. We had healthcare as something to bring us together. And now there isn't one goal. And I think that people are feeling kind of, when I said sad, maybe not sad, but a little unfulfilled, because it wasn't always just about these things. But as we were doing all of the work and all of the studying and researching, we found out the true core issue was, which is, we want our state back. Yeah. So get off the stage.
That was rank and file organizer of the West Virginia Wildcat Strike of Teachers, Olivia Morris. She was interviewed by Stacey Davis Gates, political director for the Chicago Teachers Union. Recorded by Dale Lehman from WZRD Radio in Chicago on March 9, 2018. Dale Lehman also gave me his assessment of the situation. He writes, "The strike was more than just about the teachers wanting a wage increase. It was centered on rising healthcare costs that would wipe out the 1% raise that the unions and the state were negotiating. The teachers were also demanding that all public workers receive a pay increase and health care costs be fixed, and that legislation already before the Senate to privatize schools be scrapped. At one point, the teachers were offered a settlement but refused because the other state workers were not included. The first settlement that union leaders made was made with state officials without consulting rank and file and based on nothing more than a promise from the governor. The teachers refused and stayed out on strike until they had the details in writing. Some teachers discovered a larger context and recognized that the actual issue they were fighting was not won at the end of the strike. While many teachers want to go back to teaching with a raise as victory, others see the battle just starting and are trying to figure out where to go next. That's Dale Lehman's assessment of the West Virginia Wildcat strike. And as far as where to go next is concerned, you heard Olivia Morris say they're looking at us for support and inspiration. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Dr. Vincent Antoni. Vincent Antoni is an associate professor of history and founder of the Center for Black Studies at Montgomery College in Washington, D.C. He's also director of research for American University's Nuclear Studies. He is a regular contributor to the Huffington Post, and he is here to talk about his book, African Americans Against the Bomb, Nuclear Weapons, Colonization, and the Black Freedom Movement. Vincent, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So to start out, tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, African Americans Against the Bomb?
For most of my career as an academic and also as an activist, it revolved around the Black Freedom Movement, civil rights issues. Nuclear weapons really wasn't on my radar like a lot of kids. And everything changed for me the first time I went to Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 2005. I went there as a student, and I was so filled with anger and guilt and rage about what my country had done in Japan that when I came back, I remember saying to my advisor at the time, as a young student, I need to figure out a way now to combine these two passions of mine, eliminating racism and eliminating nuclear weapons. And he said, answer me one question. What did African Americans think about dropping the bomb in 1945? And it was trying to find the answer to that question that then just started 10 years of research and taking it all the way up to Obama and ended up as a result of this book.
Yeah, I have to say, prior to hearing about your book, It was obvious that people of color had not been included at all in the fight against nuclear weapons.
Yeah, we typically look at this or think about this as being a pacifist, white, middle class issue, and that's just simply not the case. A lot of people, in fact, when I pitched this idea, said, you're crazy. You're not going to find anything, and understandably so. African Americans are too busy trying to gain their own freedom and equality and didn't have time to deal with an issue like this. But they were wrong. And so when I started looking, I think one of the first things that really caught my eye was finding the that Malcolm X had actually met with secretly with atomic bomb survivors at Yuri Kachiyama's apartment, and how he always combined this issue with colonialism and with the Black Freedom Movement. And so then it just started that process of looking at so many people. And so it was finding people inside organizations, people acting on their own, like Bayard Rustin and Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois, and then so many Black women that were influential in this, and just on and on. So it was always there, and at times it would ebb and flow, but to see this issue constantly be there in the Black community was is something that, again, is just too often overlooked, because we want to compartmentalize this. We want to take, you know, Black History Month comes and we have a picture of Martin, a picture of Rosa in our textbooks for kids, and that concludes Black History Month, and you know, keep them in their nice, neat little categorical boxes and not act as if they had any role in international relations, foreign policy, militarism, or any of these things, and that's just not the case.
So talk about specifically, when did the resistance to nuclear weapons first start in the Black community?
Immediately. So first thing to understand is that there was an affinity with Japan already built in before the bomb was ever dropped. People often forget that when Italy invaded Ethiopia in 1935, it was the Japanese that came to the defense and said they were going to help their colored brothers and sisters. It was during Japanese internment. Nothing's monolithic, so it's not to say everybody in the Black community thought the same. But there were many in the Black community with Japanese internment that said, here are a group of people that are being put in these concentration camps for no reason except the color of their skin. This could happen to us, and actually tried to sneak food and clothes into these to the concentration camps. So people like W.E.B. Du Bois had already been traveling in Asia and was lionized in Japan. This was all before the bomb was dropped. And so when we dropped the bomb, before there was any organized movement, some of the first groups to come out against it, of course, were the atomic scientists and religious groups, Fellowship of Reconciliation, but also those in the Black community, not, and again, any major organization, just individuals even coming out, pastors in Black churches, and certainly in the Black press were so many early on, Pittsburgh Courier, Chicago Defender, Baltimore Afro-American, where the Black community really got their information from. They were seeing columnists write about this as well.
What about the regular people? I understand through some of your research, there was people who were writing letters to the editor.
Yeah, so I wanted to, besides getting the bigger names that we know of, I wanted to feel what was going on in the community. So I started going through letters to the editor, which, you know, for kids today, when I talk to students today, they can go into ProQuest and they can put in a few keywords, hit enter, and it's all right there. And for me, I was in the Library of Congress on microfilm going through issue by issue and painstakingly, but it didn't matter if it was beauty shop owners or it was truck drivers or it was domestic workers. It was all the same, and it was very much a very apocalyptic version of this. Like, we don't have enough religion to stop this. This genie's out of the bottle. What are we going to do? Even those that were happy about the war ending weren't expressing a celebratory attitude towards the bomb, because we also see that there are, in the Black press, there's praise for African-Americans who worked on the bomb project. But again, if you go back and look at them, they're praising them for being these wonderful mathematicians and scientists, showing that they can work side by side with whites and showing that this should lead to equality, not praise for the actual bomb itself.
I don't know all the details on it yet, but I know that they're with the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, that blacks worked a lot on that facility, on building it anyway, and that they were segregated off into, I believe, Pasco at the time.
Yes, this is a part of the larger environmental racism or environmental justice and how these things are connected. So what we start to see happening is one, nuclear testing early in the 1950s done on Black veterans. So we were taking veterans that had fought and then sending them out to Nevada and then not telling them what we were doing and testing nuclear weapons on them. They, of course, were filled with cancer, and there was nothing done for them. The atomic veterans, both Black and white, are still around today. And actually, one of the only apologies or anything that ever came of it was in the 90s with Bill Clinton, but nobody ever really paid attention to it, because I believe it was the same day that the OJ verdict came out. So I was a little overshadowed. But I still talk with a lot of the atomic veterans, and even as some of them are passing on, about trying to get a medal for them and trying to get their recognition. And actually, the most recent person who blocked it was John McCain. of all people. But yes, we also see this in what you're talking about, Hanford, with the Savannah River Project, and that was in Georgia, where again they were doing the same thing, hiring African Americans to work in these bomb plants, not giving them any kind of protection, and they are scrubbing walls and they are cleaning this nuclear waste, getting nothing in return, filled with cancer. So. With nuclear weapons destroys everything in their path. They don't discriminate, but those who possess them do. And so when we look at everything from economic conversion to nuclear testing around the world to building the bombs, where the uranium comes from, and et cetera, where they've been used, it is people of color who are more affected in many ways than other populations.
Talk about Bayard Rustin and the connection to a movement that developed in Africa.
Yeah, Rustin has a long history of activism, of course, dating back to the 1930s. And it's so tragic that two in particular, Bayard Rustin and Paul Robeson, are so forgotten in our history. And of course, Rustin has been marginalized because he was gay, so he is iced out of this history, and kids don't even know his name, when in fact you may have not had a March on Washington without Rustin. He was the organizer. He was an amazing organizer. And so Rustin felt so strongly about this issue and was surrounded, though, by white pacifists who didn't want to take as a militant a stance as he did in many cases. So when the French want to be a nuclear power and on a world stage, and they decide they're going to test their first nuclear weapon, and they make the announcement they're going to do it in the Sahara. And you had this right at the time as the Algerian Revolution was happening. You had this right at the time is when Nkrumah was coming to power in Ghana. And the people in Ghana feared that the nuclear fallout would affect the cocoa industry. And so Rustin puts a team together of British activists and himself and African activists and goes to Africa on a mission to stop the French test. And he argues it's the most important work he had ever done. They're literally laying their bodies on the line. Eventually, the French do test their nuclear weapon, but it leads to protests all around the continent. It leads to Nkrumah having follow-up World Without the Bomb conferences and being an activist against this. But not everybody wanted this. A. Philip Randolph at the time was sending letters to Rustin saying, you need to come back here. Enough of this stuff. That we're trying to get ready for John Kennedy and the primaries in the 1960 convention, and we need now for you to be back here working on civil rights. And Rustin's writing letters back to him saying, don't you understand how colonialism and how this is all connected? You can't separate these things. And so finally Rustin says to the black leaders in the United States, I'm going to leave it in your hands. You decide. And they want him to come back. So he eventually does. And A.J. Musty goes to kind of fill in for him in Africa. But yeah, he always said it was some of the most important, if not the most important work he'd ever done in his entire career.
That's wild, because wasn't that a criticism for Martin Luther King too, on the issues he was trying to expand the entire movement to? And they're saying, no, you need to stay focused.
Absolutely. And again, what we tend to do is we want to, preserve King on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. If I Have a Dream ends his life. And we're hearing all of this now because of next week, not only a year, 50 years from when he died, the day he died, but also, of course, April 4th, 1967, a year to the day he died when he gave his Beyond Vietnam speech. We would argue is that last year is when he was the most radical. And we're starting to see more and more people highlight that year and really focus on that and show that there was so much more to him in terms of how he looked at economics with democratic socialism and how he looked at the sanitation worker strike and of course, his triple evils. But when you look at nuclear weapons, the fascinating thing about King is he was talking and speaking out against nuclear weapons a decade earlier. I first found him talking about this as early as 1957. And so he consistently talked about this and would talk at Spelman or in black churches to other civil rights leaders and say, what is it? It makes no sense to care about integrating lunch counters and not worry about the world in which you're trying to integrate. Or what does it matter if we finally achieve this social justice if we're all dead from nuclear war? So he was constantly pushing these things. And yes, of course, in the last year of his life, many turned on him for this, thought he should just focus on civil rights, not speak out against Vietnam or nuclear weapons. Even Bayard Rustin at the end, his views and King's end up actually becoming inverted by the end in that last year, because Rustin wants nothing to do with communism at this point and ties the Vietnam anti-war movement to that. So he's very much against King going out and doing these things. He actually changes his views later in life. During that period. So yeah, King is always focused on this while he's looking at civil rights. And the thing is, where he learned a lot of this from was his wife, of course. Coretta was such a seasoned activist dating back to her days at Antioch College. She had been a seasoned activist with Women's Strike for Peace, Women's International League of Peace and Freedom. So she had, you know, always talked to him about combining peace and civil rights and how these things are interconnected.
And again, in the rewriting of history, the patriarchal society always, you know, focuses on King and nothing of Coretta Scott King.
Absolutely. Not just Coretta. You had so many black women that were involved in this, from her to Erna Prather Harris, to Lorraine Hansberry, Marianne Anderson, Shirley Graham Du Bois, so many. And not only do we forget that history, but for many of these women, they were dealing with not only a patriarchy, but a race prejudice inside these women's organizations that were dominated by white women that thought this should be a single issue, that thought you shouldn't be bringing race into this. So they were often navigating this racism within these groups and trying to deal with both things at once.
And the single issues issue comes up a lot with, let's say, Black Lives Matter currently. I mean, that seems to be this critique that constantly follows almost any type of issue that someone is choosing to focus on, some groups are focusing on.
Right. And again, what you can really learn, I think, a lot when we look at intersectionality is such a buzzword now and how all these things are connected. And I believe that they are, certainly. But that issue, I think we really can learn a lot from any recent with Parkland and what this last march. Now, I've been to a lot of rallies and protests and marches in my day, and I brought so many of my students to this recent one in Washington for gun violence. And I would argue it was one of the best I'd ever been to, if not the best, simply for looking at how they organized it, who they had speaking, the crowd. Like, it was just incredible in a lot of ways. One thing I thought, and it was a recent article written about this that they did brilliantly, is they managed to still make the main focus the focus about gun violence, but yet they were clearly intersectional throughout that entire rally. Chicago was well represented. They had speakers to make sure that black females were discussed and why they're being marginalized. They had the girl talking about Sensational LA in the Hispanic community. So they were talking very clearly about all these other issues, whether it was feminism or whether it was racism. These things were all interweaved throughout this. Yet gun violence was still the main thing they were pivoting around. And so I think that's what has to happen. And what we did see happen is certainly in June 12th, 1982, the large rally, and that's what I'm writing a book on now, and doing interviews with organizers there in intersectionality in the issue of, do we include Lebanon in this march? Do we include El Salvador in this march? Do we include what was then a Black Lives Matter? They just didn't call it that back then. And so there were all these debates about what we should do, and they managed to include those with still having nuclear weapons as being the main focus, and they just pivot around that. And I think that's what we can learn from that. You certainly can do both.
Okay, so related just to, since you brought it up, the rally that happened last weekend, heavy critique on social media about, oh, did they talk about how the U.S. is killing people in other countries? You know, we're fine with removing guns from our streets, but no one brings up that, you know, and justifiably so, that is a major issue. Can you, since you were there, can you fill me in if they did touch that?
Sure. First of all, let's, again, keep in perspective, and I think they are brilliant and they are way ahead of their time, but they are 17-year-olds. So we're not expecting them to have I didn't expect them to have a large critique of U.S. foreign policy and start debating neoliberalism and what Trump's doing. This wasn't the rally to do that, right? So that's the thing is, you know, versus when you had certain organizations, I remember during the Iraq War, where I thought the Iraq War protests, I thought UFPJ was great. I was very critical of ANCER. I'm very critical when ANCER does any rallying or organizing. I think it's awful. I think the speakers go on, drivel on and on and on, and you end up having all these larger issues of militarism. And again, there's a place and a space for that. But the other thing was doing these interviews for this June 12th march and talking to them, one of the things they were really focused on was making sure they got middle America, making sure they got different communities involved in this. And it's how you got a million people without the internet in Central Park to rally against nuclear weapons. So imagine if these kids had come out and said, we're going to now start railing against U.S. foreign policy. We're going to start railing against the military industrial complex. We're going to rail. Would you have gotten 800,000 people and then all these sister marches all over? So again, it's not to say these things are all connected, and if somebody wants to do a march on that, great, we'll support it. But we need to keep things in perspective in that regard, and I think, you know, so with social media, you're going to have all, you know, anybody that wants a critique, they're going to critique, but, you know.
So talk about one of the aspects is obviously colonialism in your book. Talk more about the connection between colonialism and nuclear weapons.
Yeah, one of the first to really come out against and connect this colonialism issue was Paul Robeson. Robeson in 46, a year after the atomic bombing, there's a rally in Madison Square Garden. 20,000 people are there, and they're talking about this stuff, and he's the one that brings it up, and he asked the question, where is the U.S. getting the uranium to build nuclear weapons? And the answer, of course, was the Belgian-controlled Congo. And he was making those connections that of how colonialism works with the West and how it affects and how it is related to nuclear weapons. There was the issue, again, of at that point who had nuclear weapons and how they were using this, as Gar Alperovitz talks about atomic diplomacy as blackmail to get then resources out of various places. You have – and then again – excuse me, when you have even King starting to say injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. You had Malcolm that was talking about how what's happening in the non-white world is all connected. And so Rustin, again, looking at the French and looking at it as an act of colonialism and what they were doing in Africa. So you see that, you know, over and over again, us during the Vietnam War threatening to use nuclear weapons multiple times. And of course, what did we want? We really wanted to, you know, get a foothold into Southeast Asia for rubber, tin, oil, you know, iron ore, all of these things, natural resources. So I don't see how you can, you know, pull colonialism out of this, even when you look at issues with nuclear testing, whether it's in the Marshall Islands or whether it's Native American lands, whether it was Kazakhstan for Russia or their Australian Aborigines, over and over again, it's people, French Polynesia, people of color that suffer this nuclear colonialism, is what you could really call it. So yeah, I think it's always there, and you can't really separate it. And the best evidence of that is when you look in 1955, such a critical year on so many fronts. In the summer of 55, you have the heinous murder of Emmett Till. And later in the year, in December, Rosa Parks refuses to give up her seat on the bus. In the middle of that, you had the Bandung Conference, the all-African-Asian conference, first ever in Indonesia. And if you look at their platform, they're very clear that they were against colonialism, nuclear weapons, and white supremacy. These are the three main things they're talking about. And some U.S. representatives actually send congratulatory messages and welcome messages, but at the Bandung Conference, such a remarkable time in our history, that again doesn't get connected when it's really in this larger frame of the Black Freedom Movement.
And these three issues, all these issues, are still embedded in the fabric today.
Absolutely, and I don't think there's any more clear evidence of that than having a nuclear weapons ban treaty passed at the United Nations, where you have over 100 countries, most of them, the majority of them being non-white, majority people of color. And at the same time, 90% of the world's nuclear weapons are in the possession of two authoritarian white nationalist leaders in the world right now, with Trump and Putin. I mean, you can't have a bigger juxtaposition right now when you have a majority of the non-white world asking to end this madness, and then you have these two men wanting to start a new arms race, essentially.
And or actively use their weapons in third world countries.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, threatening to use them, using them in third world countries. And what are the countries that are being – and people will say, well, but you're ignoring, you know, that Pakistan has nuclear weapons and India and China. Absolutely. I'm not ignoring that at all. It's not to say only, you know, the White West has – nuclear weapons, but we are looking at who has the majority of them right now and who would be harmed by it just in general. I mean, if just Pakistan and India had a small conflict, you're talking billions with a B that would be dead through famine and through the temperature changing and through the fallout. You hear Trump talking about, you know, and this is another thing of that we don't focus enough on, is the economic conversion piece that was done so well in the 1980s. Where I live in Washington, D.C., recently this winter in Baltimore, there were a lot of schools in Baltimore that literally didn't have money for heat. So they were asking kids to bring in space heaters. So you had space heaters in Baltimore City schools. And at the same time, you have a president that is willing to spend $1.2 trillion on more nuclear weapons when we already have enough to end civilization. So it's educating and letting people know that, you know, how these connections are made, that you cannot talk about one without talking about the other. And that, again, is something that we're not doing enough of right now.
And talk about the strength of this fabric of colonialism that is holding the current power structure together. because for a brief period there, we saw with the Obama administration that it appeared that he was anti-nuclear and anti-nuclear weapons, and then boom, he turned around and infused military-industrial complex with the largest spending spree in history.
Yeah, Obama has spoken out and seemingly been against nuclear weapons since he was a college student. He was a journalist at the June 12, 1982 march, wrote about it in college. And I think that he had done a lot of positive steps very early on. He had his nuclear summits, and he worked to get loose nuclear weapons making materials in safe hands, which he successfully did in a lot of countries. In fact, he got enough material out of the Ukraine for 4 nuclear weapons before it fell into chaos. I think he deserves credit for the New START Treaty and, of course, for I think the most important thing he did as president was the Iran nuclear deal without firing a shot through diplomacy. Does that mean that he doesn't deserve criticism? Of course not. He didn't. I would have liked him to take nuclear weapons off air trigger alert before he left, obviously, with who came next. Decrease the amount of nuclear weapons, not sign on for this $1 trillion or $2 trillion modernization plan. But at the end of the day, I don't put that on him. I put that on us. Everything that we have wanted, we have had to push for, everything that we've gotten. So if we wanted this, we needed a million people in the streets demanding that this end. He was asked once during his campaign in 08, would Martin Luther King support you? And he said, no, King would be out in the streets making me do what I said I was going to do. He got it. He knew it. So it has to be on us, you know. And I think there was just with Obama, there was a level of there was such racism and such obstruction against him that for a lot of us that normally are against the man, we were saying, wait, our man is the man, and how do we handle this? And do we go at protest him, but the other side is so horrific? And I think there was a lot of that. Do we give him a pass on something when maybe we shouldn't, and all of these kind of things? And so, and I think there was, and again, I'm not saying it's the right thing, but some people also trusted him and, you know, say, okay, he's not. And, you know, you think to me, the most important question when you're going to go in a voting booth, forget even party, is if we are faced with another Cuban Missile Crisis, who do you want sitting in that chair? And people felt confident having the cool, calm, collected, Harvard educated lawyer sitting in that chair versus what we have now. So, but yeah, as far as, you know, this issue goes, I think, you know, obviously it's maddening where we're at now with colonialism or with nuclear testing or with money being spent, all of it. It's horrific.
Only a few minutes left. In your book, you have examples of individuals who, when they couldn't find an organization representing their viewpoints, they created it.
Right. There were many in the Black community that were wanted to be part of this. And when they were either joining or trying to support a predominantly white organization, they were faced with, again, internal prejudice and racism. They were pushed to the side. They were told, as you know, we're not really going to reach out to the Black community. There's nothing there. They don't care. And so when I was writing this book and writing for HuffPost and others, this gentleman contacted me and Greg Johnson. He said, I need to talk to you and show you all the stuff I have. And him and his wife, Greg and Brenda, at the time, African-Americans. One was a librarian at Georgetown University, ordinary citizens. And they cared deeply about this issue. And this was during the 1980s. And nobody was reaching out to them. So with a rotary phone and one flyer, they started the group Blacks Against Nukes. And that grew to multiple chapters and hundreds of members. And they were featured on the cover of Ebony and Jet magazine and were asked to speak in Hiroshima. And it's just an example of ordinary people doing something extraordinary, you know, not waiting for this movement to come to them, but then go ahead and doing it. So if you really examine that, the 1980s, you see, and again, beyond Obama, I know we have to wrap up, but, you know, he certainly wasn't the first one. If you look at the Congressional Black Caucus, Jesse Jackson, Ron Dellums, if you look at Harold Washington, there's a long list of Black politicians that really put this front and center and worked hard on this. And we need that again.
And even organizations that wove this into the fabric of what they were doing, for instance, the Black Panther Party, which was so key in doing so many things that we see today, like, you know, the breakfast program. And we have clinics here in Seattle that still to this day are functioning due to the Black Panther Party.
Yeah, which is really the revolutionary stuff and what really made the FBI look at them, not the guns and the rhetoric. It's these programs. But in terms of this, if you people don't think of nuclear weapons when they think of the Panthers. But if you go back and read Executive Mandate Number 1 that Bobby Seale read in Sacramento, it clearly connects the Black Freedom Movement to the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, of course, I talked to him about it. And he had said, we did that on purpose. We always looked at ourselves in an international light, which is why Kathleen Cleaver and Eldridge and others were asked to speak in Hiroshima. And they always viewed themselves in the same way.
All right. We are just about out of time. We're talking with Dr. Vincent Intondi. He's author of the book African Americans Against the Bomb, Nuclear Weapons, Colonialism, and the Black Freedom Movement. And you are speaking Monday night here in town in Seattle at University of Washington, Bagley Hall, room 131 at 6 p.m. Doors open at 5:45. So looking forward to that. And you're also, while you're in town, you're working with Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. And I'm wondering if we can drag Laura over to the mic for a second and get you to tie this issue in real quick with your work that you're doing currently.
Thanks, Mike.
Your organization.
Yeah, Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility is a proud member of a statewide coalition that we started about a year and a half ago called Washington Against Nuclear Weapons. So this is a growing statewide coalition of members of the faith community, health professionals, communities of color, peace organizations, educators. And we're all working together to raise awareness about nuclear weapons issues, particularly here in Washington State, and to put pressure on our members of Congress to reduce the threat of nuclear war and the threat posed by nuclear weapons, especially here in Washington State. So you can learn more on our website, WPSR.org. We invite you to join us and hope to see some of you on Monday at University of Washington, 6 o'clock at Bagley Hall.
Very good. And as I try and regularly point out to folks, we are blessed in a way where we're located here in Seattle. We happen to, if you draw a line between Hanford Nuclear Reservation, which is the most toxic site in the Western Hemisphere from its production of plutonium for nuclear bombs, and the Bangor Trident Nuclear Subbase that's 20 miles here from Seattle, which is the largest repository of nuclear weapons in the Western Hemisphere. We have a unique role where we're located at and a motivation, I would hope, towards solving this problem once and for all in a good way. So with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you for having me and all the work that you're doing on this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.